Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Secular Sunday here on Radio Free Kansas. I'm your host, Mike Cadell. I have quite a lineup available here. I'm also happy to report that we had almost 600 downloads since last Sunday of our Secular Sunday episode, and it's going quite well. It's very steady traffic and downloads. Let's see, I have a couple announcements to make. One, we are falling far behind. We really need to raise some money to pay our yearly network dues. And we have till the end of January to do so. It's less than $1,000, and it's not much, really. So I'd like to make a special request, and I'm sorry to start the program out this way, but it's important that we do this. To send any checks or money orders, something to give generously if you can afford to. However, any amount will be accepted at send your checks or money orders to People's Culture, P.O. Box 5224, Kansas City, Kansas, zip code 66119. Again, that's People's Culture, P.O. Box 5224, Kansas City, Kansas, zip code 66119, and be sure in the memo line put RFK or Radio Free Kansas so they'll know to direct the funds to us. Now, on a more pleasant note, I don't like doing that, I want to remind you that Don Kimmerling and Gary Purdom at KKFI FM 90.1 live streams, KKFI live streams, and from 7 to 8 every Sunday morning, you can listen to the Voice of Reason coming out of Kansas City, Missouri, who'll give you many, many scheduled activities going on in the area. As well, they usually broadcast Point of Inquiry, which regular listeners of Secular Sunday might be familiar with now. Point of Inquiry is one of our favorite. I dip into their podcast archives and play for you. The KKFI is live streams from 7 to 8. You get a lot of great insight, plus great commentary from Don Kimmerling and Gary Purdom at kkfi.org. And you can email them at VOR, that's for the acronym for Voice of Reason, VORKKFI@yahoo.com. Also, they have a great website, KC Free Thought. Now, there's no spaces in that. kcfreethought.org. Their website's very active, has lots of activity going on in it. It's well worth your time. And one more news announcement, then we'll get into our program. Upcoming Darwin birthday event at February 9th will be held in Wichita, Kansas, and I haven't got a place yet. However, you can find them on Facebook under, just do a search, Great Plains AU. That's Great Plains, P-L-A-I-N-S, AU, to get your information on it. It's going to be held, wait a minute here. Oh, yeah, here it is. It's we celebrate, they'll have a speaker, food, and a birthday cake to celebrate Arwen's birthday. The speaker will be Dr. Teresa McDonald, Director of Education at the University of Kansas Natural History Museum. Again, that's February 9th in Wichita. I'll get the details to you, I'm sure, by next Sunday. But you can find out and be most up to date. Just go to the Great Plains AU on Facebook. Looking here. That's all. And there'll be all. Now, for many of you regular listeners, also, I want to direct your attention to our late night programs, which can be downloaded anytime, Monday, Wednesday, Friday evenings at 10 p.m. here. And you'll be able to. On those nights, I'm going to start doing, I have been, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday nights, broadcasting a lot of local news and events, complete with contact information. So check into it. Now we'll go on to the show. Here we go. Here's some more Joyce Lindor.
This is Kenneth Doust, host of the weekly radio program New World Notes. Hey, I found a good book I want to share. Let's make it official and have another official installment of The Book Report. Fanfare, please. The book I hold here is by a mid-level State Department career Foreign Service officer named Peter Van Buren. In 2009, he was posted to the provinces of Iraq for a year of reconstruction. He was told to spend money, generate good publicity, and, oh yes, improve the lives of the people in his district. He spent money, failed to make much improvement in anyone's life, came home, and wrote a very good, sad but funny book about his experience. It's called We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. It's published 2011 by Metropolitan Books. Van Buren and a couple other civilians became an embedded provincial reconstruction team, or EPRT. They were embedded in first one, then another small, sad military base out in the hot, sandy sticks of Iraq. He worked in the towns and villages, but he lived on the base with the enlisted soldiers. And he shared the soldiers' discomforts, the oppressive heat, the hurry up and wait, the lousy food, no privacy, no alcohol, no sex. Even Playboy magazine banned by an act of Congress, I kid you not. Ambushes and roadside bombs outside the base, occasional bullets and mortar rounds flying into the base, people you know getting killed. Not to mention ignorance of the country and its people and no clear sense of what you're doing there and what you're supposed to accomplish. This was just as true of the State Department as it was of the military. Van Buren draws sharp, subtle, and sympathetic portraits of people, especially of the common soldiers he lives with. He's much less sympathetic to the brass he takes orders from. That includes most of the colonels, all of the generals, plus most of the State Department officials. The State Department officials, his bosses, spend their time attending air-conditioned cocktail parties back in the Green Zone, and piping millions of dollars into wasteful, poorly planned reconstruction projects in the provinces. These projects are designed to generate good PR publicity for America before the projects inevitably crash and burn. The important thing is to spend millions of dollars, advance your career, stamp your ticket, move on, and the hell with the Iraqi people. This book will remind you of the novel Catch-22, except that Catch-22 is fiction and this book isn't. Like Catch-22, We Meant Well is funny. It's absurd, it's preposterous, and yet it rings very, very true. The book gives many examples of what Van Buren went through. Here's one example. Some army major decided that we would bring prosperity to the district by building a large, state-of-the-art chicken processing plant. The army had plenty of money, so millions of dollars were spent building a high-tech, highly automated stainless steel facility to slaughter, clean, and package chickens. Project management got passed on to Van Buren. Now the Iraqis like to eat chicken. Frozen chicken imported from Brazil is available cheap. Plus, local farmers raise some chickens. For special occasions, you buy a chicken from the farmer and have it slaughtered. This chicken costs more than the frozen Brazilian stuff. Eventually, some U.S. official calculated that chicken from the new poultry plant would cost even more than the local farmer's chicken. But that wasn't the biggest problem. There was no huge poultry farm that could supply the new factory with hundreds of chickens a day, or supply thousands of chicks to the local farmers to raise. Even if big poultry breeders did exist, which they didn't, all the roads were barely passable, full of bomb craters, bombs, robbers, snipers, and checkpoints manned by insurgents. Even if the chickens existed, most would never make it to the plant. Plus, the factory needed electricity. The U.S. Air Force had destroyed much of Iraq's electric grid in 1991 and destroyed most of the rest in 2003. 6 years after the U.S. invaded, and despite billions of dollars spent on supposed reconstruction, Iraqis were lucky if they got electricity 2 or 3 hours a day. Factories need a constant flow of electricity. Did I mention the lack of refrigeration? Not a problem if you buy your chicken from a local farmer, and you kill the chicken a couple hours before you eat it. A problem if you're packaging hundreds of pounds of chicken meat a day. Not that the Iraqis had any reason to buy the expensive stuff in the first place, even if you managed to produce it. But the chicken plant served its purpose. It spent lots of American taxpayers' money. It provided many photos and press releases showing how America is rebuilding Iraq. And it gave a lot of American bureaucrats, both in and out of uniform, another item to add to their resumes, even though it never did process any chicken. your tax dollars at work. And that's just one of several examples Van Buren gives. For all its horror stories, We Meant Well is a very witty book. Van Buren writes in a subtle and very readable style. There's a touch of lightness and comic irony throughout. Just a touch, but enough to make a dreary story quite pleasant to read. Van Buren does not think like a government bureaucrat, and he sure doesn't write like one either. This is his first book, and I sure hope he's got some more coming. This is one of a group of books that the publishers named The American Empire Project. This series includes some very important works by some very important writers. This series includes two books by Noam Chomsky. It includes Chalmers Johnson's so-called Blowback Trilogy. It includes books by Andrew Bacevich, Michael Clare, Alfred McCoy, and others. So Peter Van Buren is in pretty good company here. Not bad for your first book. The author is Peter Van Buren. The title is We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. It's published 2011 by Metropolitan Books, an imprint of Henry Holt and Company. I found my copy at my town's free public library, an institution I urge everybody to support. Again, the book is We Meant Well. The author is Peter Van Buren, and I thank you for listening to The Book Report.
Thanks for downloading this episode of the Lapham's Quarterly Podcast. If you're a fan of the magazine, or you like the show, head over to laphamsquarterly.org and click subscribe now to get 4 issues of LQ goodness a year. And if you're feeling extra generous, click the donate link at the top of the page. Okay, here's the show.
This is Lapham's Quarterly, the podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Lapham's Quarterly Podcast. I'm LQ editor Aidan Flax Clark. Today on the show, I've got an interview I did recently with one of America's finest living historians, H.W. Brands. Brands is a 2-time Pulitzer Prize nominee and a New York Times bestselling author who has written books on American foreign policy, domestic politics, finance and economics, and he's written a number of biographies. He came on the podcast to talk to me about an essay he wrote for us in our politics issue, which takes for its subject President Ulysses S. Grant. In it, he set out to reconsider Grant's life and his career as president in light of some of the remarkably tough decisions he had to make during one of America's most troubled times, Reconstruction. This also happens to be the subject of his most recent book, The Man Who Saved the Union, Ulysses Grant in War and Peace. Brands has been writing history books since 1988, and he's written 28 in all. Though he's covered a broad swath of the American experience, much of his more recent work has veered into the territories of 19th century politics and the interaction of capital with American politics during that time. Some of the titles about these topics would include American Colossus, The Triumph of Capitalism, 1865 to 1900, Greenback Planet, How the Dollar Conquered the World and Threatened Civilization as We Know It, The Money Men, Capitalism, Democracy, and the Hundred Years' War Over the American Dollar, and The Age of Gold, The California Gold Rush and the New American Dream. He may perhaps be best known, though, for his biographies, which he's written most recently on Grant and Aaron Burr, but he's also chronicled the lives of Benjamin Franklin, Andrew Jackson, Woodrow Wilson, and Theodore Roosevelt. And it's for his books on Franklin and Roosevelt, the first American and traitor to his class, respectively, that he's been nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. H.W. Brand spoke to me over Skype from his home in Austin, where he teaches at the University of Texas. Here's the interview. So it's clear from your essay that you wrote for us and, of course, from your book that you think that Ulysses Grant, you know, has sort of an unduly poor reputation and that part of what you're writing about is trying to correct that. What do you think some of the mischaracterizations are about him that have been made over the years?
Well, first, let me say that when I set out to write about Grant, I really didn't intend to revise Grant's historical reputation. I was just interested in what made this guy tick. I was particularly interested in the mind and temperament of a soldier and how that translates into public life in America, first in war and then in peace. Now, when I got into it, and well, when I started, I was aware that Grant's reputation as a soldier was pretty good, even though there were still those invidious comparisons of Grant with Robert E. Lee, with Lee supposed to be the more brilliant one and Grant to be the more plotting one, who simply won a war of attrition that Lee couldn't have because Lee lacked the soldiers. Then there is, of course, the longstanding view that Grant was a lousy president, that he didn't understand the changes that were overtaking America, that he allowed corruption to fester within his administration, and that the country would have been much better off without him. Now, I concluded, without deliberately trying to do so, that that was a fundamental mischaracterization of Grant's presidency. Not that Grant will ever be considered a great president in terms of positive accomplishments, but the people who criticize Grant underestimate the difficulties that he faced. There was never a more difficult time to be president than during Reconstruction. And a lot of presidents could have done a lot worse than Grant did.
What led you to that conclusion? Was there one thing that you were reading about and you said, oh, you know, they've got it wrong on this fact or that fact?
Now, what I did was actually conduct something of a hypothetical experiment, and that was to imagine what would have happened if Lincoln had lived. And Lincoln is considered probably by most historians to be the greatest of all presidents. I'm pretty convinced that that would not be the case had he lived into Reconstruction. Because what became very clear to me, and I, by the way, I was clued into this a little bit by the previous work that I had done on Franklin Roosevelt, who died at a comparable time of World War II, at the moment of victory. So he could claim all the laurels and leave the messy stuff of dealing with post-war settlements to his successor, Harry Truman. With Lincoln, and then with Grant, who became, in essence, Lincoln's successor and heir. Andrew Johnson was this interim president who wasn't connected to much of anything. The real question was, what do you do with secessionist sentiment after you can no longer use the army? Because a fundamental fact of the Civil War was that the Union Army defeated the South without persuading the South. Southerners had the same mindset, they had the same convictions at the end of the war that they had at the beginning of the war, short of a belief that they could actually get away with secession and create their own country. So now they were bitter, they were resentful, and they were determined to restore as much as they could of the status quo ante bellum after the war. And the Union side, first, well, this would have been Lincoln's problem, but it became Grant's problem, was what do you do in a democracy when you have, I won't say half the country, because the South was really more like a third of the country, when a third of the country fundamentally disagrees with the values that much of the rest of the country shares. And in a federal system, this is made worse because the states have their rights and prerogatives. How far can the federal government go to impose the national will on opposition within the states? And that's the question that Grant confronted. That's the question that any Reconstruction president would have confronted.
And do you think that you talk a little bit about how, you know, Grant was born in the North, but his wife was from the South, and he sort of contended with those two different worlds. Do you think that those early years of his marriage sort of made him better acclimated to those questions?
The fact that Grant had this Southern connection, and this is one of the great ironies of my story and of Grant's life, was that even while he was commanding general of the Union Army, the army that was committed to ending slavery, there were slaves in Grant's own household, slaves that belonged to his wife. And this is a reminder, first of all, how complicated history often is, but especially the history of the Civil War. It did alert Grant to sentiment in the South. If he had been from Massachusetts, he wouldn't have had the personal exposure to the slaveholding classes and to the culture of white supremacy that existed throughout the South. It wasn't as sharp in Missouri, where he lived in the 1850s and where his wife is from, as it was in South Carolina and Mississippi, but it was definitely present, and it did shape Grant's attitudes, if only because his wife encountered them. When she was traveling in the battlefield theater during the war, she would encounter Southern women who owned slaves, who knew she was from Missouri and owned slaves, and assumed that she sympathized with them and should simply just talk her husband around to their point of view.
One of the things that you, let's move past the war, one of the things that you talk about in your essay is the financial panic of 1873 and how this is sort of, it seems to be one of the pivotal moments in perhaps reassessing Grant. Could you talk about what that was and then how he responded to it that you find so interesting?
The panic of 1873 was a financial panic like others that had occurred in the United States before and that would continue in the United States recurrently until 2008. And the problem was that certain parts of the financial industry became overextended and overleveraged. And when confidence evaporated, then the money system of the United States, in this case, it was much less leveraged than it is today, but the money supply shrank dramatically. This is a problem that has been addressed at various times by different portions of the government. Early in the 19th century, there was the Bank of the United States. This is the private version of the Fed. In Grant's era, Congress controlled the monetary policy of the country. Later, it would be the Federal Reserve. What Grant was faced with after the panic of 1873 was a bill that was passed by Congress that was colloquially called the Inflation Bill. And the Inflation Bill proposed to inject $400 million of paper money into the American financial system. This was quite analogous to what Ben Bernanke has been doing over the last year and a half in trying, it's called quantitative easing, but basically creating new money out of thin air in an effort to raise prices and to get the economy moving again. Grant had to decide whether to accept this bill or to veto it. And there's a very interesting moment in Grant's presidency where at first he's inclined to accept the bill because Grant was one who exercised the veto very lightly. He thought that it ordinarily should be used only if the president thought that the law was unconstitutional, not simply if he opposes on policy grounds. So he wrote this memo to himself explaining why he should accept the inflation bill. And he basically traced out the arguments that might be given today by Paul Krugman or others on the sort of economic left who contend that what the Fed needs to do and what Congress needs to do is inject more stimulus into the economy. And he wrote that and he read it back to himself and he couldn't quite convince himself. So he tried the opposite tack. He said, okay, I'll try to write the opposite. And he wrote another memo to himself saying, I need to veto the bill and here's why I have to do it. And in writing this message, he sounded very much like fiscal conservatives today, monetary conservatives, who think that expanding the money supply is going to lead to rampant inflation down the road. Grant ultimately came down on the side of the conservatives here. He vetoed the bill. In fact, even went farther than this. The following year, he persuaded Congress to accept something called the Resumption Act, which would put the United States back on the gold standard. It had diverged from the gold standard slightly during the Civil War and it issued this dual paper currency. And the lesson of this, of Grant's experience, can be read one of two opposite ways. One is that, well, the Grant's decision to veto the inflation bill and to sign the Resumption Act eventually put the United States back on track for its economy to expand dramatically in the next 20 or 30 years. And that's true enough. The other interpretation is, yeah, but it took another 4 years of recession to dig out of this hole. So is a reminder, first of all, that the basic questions of how to manage the money supply have been around at least since the beginning of the industrial era in the United States. And a second lesson is, just because something worked out one way in history is no sure guide to how it's going to work out now. It's very often a question of how you measure the short-term costs against the long-term gains, and who can stand the short-term pain to get the long-term benefit.
Now, this kind of thoughtfulness that you describe in his approach to this question, what do you attribute that to? Because, you know, he's known as a military man. You described that he's pretty much a failure in business. He sounds like he has a critical eye for battle, but where do you think that comes from?
Well, the basic problem in Grant's ability to make much of his own life before the Civil War was a lack of ambition or pushiness or drive, the kind of thing that really made John Rockefeller and Andrew Carnegie and Bill Gates and people like that successful. A need to somehow complete himself by what he accomplished in the world. I have been studying about presidents and other people who achieve great things in history for a long time. And most of them are driven by some kind of personal need to make their mark on the world. With Grant, I looked and looked, and I couldn't find it. It was probably most striking in the last year or so before the Civil War, when Grant had been forced to fall back on a longstanding offer of his father to go to work in the family business. He had resisted it and resisted it, but everything else had failed. And so he almost was starving with his young family, and he had no choice but to take this. And while another person might have seen this as an utter failure and lamented the way his life was going, Grant seemed to just sort of settle into it. He sort of resigned himself to mediocrity. And he wasn't thrilled about it by any means. He still had issues with his father. But if the Civil War had never come and Grant had lived out the rest of his days in the family leather business in Galena, I don't know that he would have been horribly disappointed with his life. He had no particularly high expectations. The Civil War did come. It demonstrated that he was a genius at war. But even then, he had no burning ambition to accept the presidency. And he certainly didn't run for the presidency. But he believed that if he didn't take the job, then the victory that was won on the battlefield would be lost in the political realm. That he was sort of the last of the Lincolnians. And so he allowed himself to answer the call of duty on the part of the people to take the presidency, just as he had answered the call of duty to take up arms during the Civil War.
It's almost a Cincinnatus figure in that respect, I guess.
Yeah, except with Cincinnatus, we have this idea that, you know, he is this really great figure even when he's at his plow.
Mm-hmm.
With Grant, you know, Grant became a very popular figure, but even at the very end of his life, when he was completing his memoirs, he knew he was dying of cancer. In fact, this is the scene that I used to open the book. He writes some notes to himself, and one of the notes that he writes says that, you know, even after everything that's happened, it still surprises me that I became the commander of the arm that won the Great War, and I was twice elected president of the United States. One of the things that I found very appealing about Grant was he retained his modesty even after he became certainly the most popular man in America, and he had a world tour after he left the White House. He might well have been one of the most popular figures in the entire world in that era. But he said quite candidly that there were other people who could have done the job as well as he had. He said William Sherman, for example, could have commanded the Union armies as well as I could have. It demonstrated that he was very far from those people who believe that somehow fate has singled them out to achieve great things.
Just funny, because you can't imagine a president like that today. I mean, nowhere near it.
That's one of the reasons that I wanted to write the story, because our expectations of presidents and presidential candidates have changed dramatically. In the 19th century, presidential candidates did not campaign. That would have been considered very unsavory, because the job was supposed to seek the individual. One of the reasons for this as well was that in the 19th century, the center of political gravity in the country, except during wartime, lay at the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue in Congress, which is what the founders intended. The first article of the Constitution describes Congress. It's only the second article that gets to the presidency. 20th century, the presidents become celebrities. And now, if candidates don't have what is called that fire in the belly, that's considered to be a disqualification. In the 19th century, that fire in the belly would have been a dangerous ambition that should cause you to stay away from that candidate. We've made a cult of the presidency. The presidency was important in the 19th century, primarily because who controlled the presidency controlled all these civil, well, actually they weren't civil service yet, public offices, thousands of postmasterships and the like. And this was the way political parties held themselves together. So the mere fact that Grant was a Republican meant that there would be Republican postmasters all over the country. But presidents weren't expected to take the initiative in running the country. They weren't expected to propose a budget, for example, to Congress. And in the 19th century, the United States had a very intermittent foreign policy. So the president wasn't commander-in-chief except when he was actually commander-in-chief.
Right, right. Getting back to Grant, one thing that I wanted to ask you about is Grant the writer. You know, you quote a number of his letters, and it seems as if he was a rather prolific letter writer. And of course, you mentioned he wrote his memoirs, which you say every president since then has looked to as an example. How would you assess his skills as a writer, and what do you think prompted him in that direction?
Grant's great strength as a writer was his ability to write clearly and concisely. And this, you could see it a little bit when he wrote personal letters home from the war with Mexico. So there was something about Grant's way of thinking that was very direct, very linear, get from A to B and do it in the most efficient way. But this particular talent or this characteristic of his writing was confirmed and reinforced during the Civil War. Grant was writing dozens of orders every day. And there's one thing about a military order. It has to be clear. And it has to be succinct. It's, you know, the person receiving it needs to know exactly what is expected, and the orders have to be timely. So if you read Grant's orders during the war, and then you read Grant's memoir, you see very much the same writing style. His sentences are linear. They're just straightforward. His paragraphs are laid out the same way. When Grant was writing his memoir, there were plenty of people who thought that who is this general? He's never written a book before. He's probably not writing it. Oh, you know, his publisher, it's Mark Twain. I'll bet Mark Twain is ghostwriting the memoir. Mm. A lot of people had this impression, and I still get this question today. But if you compare Grant's writing to Twain's writing, Twain was a fine writer. There's no question about it. But if you compare Grant's writing, let's say, in his Civil War orders, and then you look at the memoir, it's very clear that there was almost no editing of Grant's manuscript that was done. And if you want to put it another way, Mark Twain was a fine writer, but there's no way on earth that Mark Twain could have written Grant's memoir. The style is so divergent. Twain writes all around his subject. Grant writes straight to the subject.
It's hard to picture Twain writing a presidential memoir with a straight face, too. I mean, it just doesn't seem like his style.
Well, that's it. By the way, you called Grant's memoir a presidential memoir. That's sort of the trick question, the trick answer to the question of which is the best presidential memoir. Grant's memoir is the best by a former president, but it doesn't deal with the presidency. And there are two reasons for this. One is that Grant realized that his public, and by the way, he wrote the book only under the duress of bankruptcy. He had been swindled in a scam that was orchestrated by the Gilded Age equivalent of Bernie Madoff. Mm. And he knew that he would leave his wife without money. There were no presidential pensions in those days. And so he wrote the memoir to make some money. He knew that his public was interested in the Civil War. Presidents until then had not written memoirs. The presidential memoir is very much a 20th century thing. There wasn't market for a memoir of a presidency. And I've read, I think, every presidential memoir. It's a really dismal genre, you know, because you know, the stuff they tell you about was all acted out in public. It's a matter of apologetics. This is why we did what we did. Now that you know what I knew, you'll agree with me. But Grant's is the story of the great drama, the great tragedy in American history, told by someone who was in the thick of it. And the other aspect of Grant's memoir that gives it such conviction and appeal is the knowledge in Grant, while he was writing it, that he was dying. And so it acquires the sort of the authenticity and the stature of deathbed testimony. Grant no longer has any access to Grant. He has no future to worry about. He's able to be fair and complimentary of his opponents when that's warranted, is able to admit his own mistakes. In fact, some very grievous mistakes. In his memoir, he talks about the final assault that he ordered at the Battle of Cold Harbor, in which thousands were killed to no avail at all. And he says, you know, this was, it was a horrible mistake. And you could tell it had haunted him all this while. Presidents these days don't admit that kind of stuff in their memoirs.
So, you know, you talk about how, or you mentioned earlier that, you know, he's obviously an extremely popular general. He was quite popular during his presidency. You say if he wanted to, he could have been elected maybe one or two more times. And yet, soon after his death, his reputation, you know, declined pretty precipitously. What do you attribute that to?
A couple of things. One is that Grant, like all presidents, had political opponents even while he was in office. And the political opponents tended to be the most articulate elements of the Republican Party. Republican intellectuals who didn't like the direction that the party was going, who they didn't like the fact, well, Henry Adams was a good example. You know, Henry Adams, the son of Charles Francis Adams, thought that the Republic sort of should have been better to him than it wasn't, couldn't quite figure out why history had passed him by. His great-grandfather had been president. His grandfather had been president. He wasn't anything at all. And so this group of people objected to the fact that a general was now running the country. Furthermore, this wing of the party, which broke off and called itself the Liberal Republicans, they wanted essentially to forget about the anti-slavery roots of the Republican Party. They wanted to get on with the business of developing America. And so they wanted to make up with the South and let Reconstruction be as easy as possible, which meant that they were simply going to write off the freedmen, the former slaves, and let them be left to the tender mercies of the white majorities in the South. So they already had it in for Grant. Furthermore, Southerners in the South, white Southerners in the South, who regained control of the Southern state governments during, well, mostly during Grant's presidency, they certainly didn't want to give Grant any credit as president because Grant was the last person to stand up for the rights of African Americans. In fact, Grant's the only president between Abraham Lincoln and Lyndon Johnson to take civil rights at all seriously and try to put some teeth into the 14th and 15th Amendments. But he couldn't hold back the tide of white prejudice. So Grant's so-called liberal Republican opponents made common cause after Grant's presidency with the whites in the South. And the whites in the South very quickly developed this idea of the lost cause. It gets back to what I was saying earlier about they lost the war, but they didn't think they lost the argument. And in contrast to the old cliche about the victors write the histories, in American history, the losers wrote the history of the Civil War. So by the beginning of the 20th century, it was the Southern interpretation of the Civil War, as primarily about states' rights, and not about slavery, of Reconstruction as this carnival of corruption where evil Northern carpetbaggers and beastly Southern blacks briefly took control of Southern state governments until they were driven from office by the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. This was the interpretation of the Civil War that persisted from the end of the 19th century until well into the 20th century, and it had no room for a president like Grant who said, hold on a minute here. This country is based on the principles of equality. We fought the Civil War in large part, eventually anyway, to free the slaves, and now we have to grant them their political rights. And so Grant had to be written out of that picture, and he was for a century or so.
Now, when you come to write about someone like Grant, or, you know, you've written about FDR and Teddy Roosevelt, who's been well covered, I'm curious to know, what inspires you when you write those kinds of books? You mentioned with Grant that you wanted to examine the life of a soldier in War and Peace, but I mean, you also picked Grant specifically. So do you ever find that you're looking to unearth new information or correct misperceptions, or do those people just happen to be models for questions that you want to answer? How do you approach these subjects that have been well covered?
I'm always on the lookout for new information, and new information always comes up. For example, in the case of Grant, there was, over the course of about 40 years, a wonderful edited edition of Grant's papers that was produced by Southern Illinois University Press. And they had a team of editors, a whole team of researchers that scoured archives all over the country, getting letters that Grant wrote out, getting letters that were written to the White House. They're able to do a whole lot more than any single historian can do unaided. And when I took up writing the book, this collection was nearing its completion, and the most recent part had to do with Grant's presidency. And there was an intriguing batch of letters written to Grant from different southern states during the era of Reconstruction. And very often they were from southern blacks and southern Republicans, explaining about the latest raid by the Ku Klux Klan, the latest effort of intimidation on the part of white Southern Democrats to keep African Americans, to keep Republicans from getting to the polls. It was really sort of the last battle of the Civil War. And these were reports from the front. This gave me insight that really wasn't readily available to other people who had written about Grant. But that's not the reason I took up the project. I think that every generation deserves its own look at important moments in its past. And the questions that we would pose of, say, a Grant administration are different than the questions that would have been posed 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 50 years ago. If I had written this book in 2005, the Grant's veto of the inflation bill probably wouldn't have played as large a role in my story as it did, because it wouldn't have resonated with the decision that's facing Congress, the president, and the Federal Reserve today over, do we expand the money supply or do we not? And so as the present changes, our interpretations and our appreciation of the past changes. The other thing is just the last, and I'll say that this probably appeals to me as much as anything. If there is a good story to be told in history, you know, it's worth retelling. And if you tell it well, you will find readers. I teach at the University of Texas, and so I have access in the libraries there to every biography of Grant that's ever been written, essentially. And so if there was a really good biography of Grant that was written in the 1980s, William McFeely's biography of Grant is considered the starting point for Grant biographies, and it's a really good book. But it essentially doesn't exist for people who don't have access to research libraries. And so I could start with my students who are 20 years old. If they read my book on Grant, it'll be the first one they've ever read. But for a whole lot of people, it's the same way. If you walk into a bookstore these days and you look for books on Grant, well, there's Grant's memoir has always been on the shelf. But a book that's been was published 5, 6, 8 years ago, it largely disappears from view. So there's always room for telling an important story if you think you can tell it well.
Well, to be fair, it's the first book I've read on Grant, so I'm a living example of what you're talking about. Now, a lot of your work in recent years seems to have focused very heavily on the second half of the 19th century. Can you tell me why that period has been the center of your focus? Are there resonances today that you see that were important in the period that you're studying now?
Oh, I'm very intrigued by the 19th century. And the way I put it is this, that there are two institutions that characterize the United States today, two institutions and value sets. One is democracy, and the other is capitalism. And if you describe the United States as a capitalist democracy in two words, you've nailed about 90% of what makes the United States what it is. And the striking thing about this is that neither capitalism nor democracy existed in the United States at the beginning of the 19th century. And both were pretty fully developed by the end of the 19th century. So from the historian's point of view, if something doesn't exist in 1800 and does exist in 1900, then between those two times, it must have come into existence. So the way I look at it, I wrote a book about Andrew Jackson. And Andrew Jackson, the story of Jackson's career in life is the emergence of democracy. To put it very shorthand, democracy emerges in the United States. At least the concept of the idea on which the rest will be built is fully in place by 1850. Once Jackson gets elected, and the principle that ordinary people, and at least at this point, adult white males, can run the government, can hold political power. Once that's accepted, then everything else that has followed is more or less inevitable. Might take a while, but it's going to happen. Capitalism emerges in the second half of the 19th century, and this is in answer to your question. Because if you look at what makes the American economy today what it is, you can see about 95% of that emerging in the 19th century. And in fact, over the course of the last 10 or 15 years, it seems to me that the American economy has grown more and more like the economy of the Gilded Age. And it's not that I am looking to the 19th century to find answers to the early 21st century. In fact, I mean, that kind of presentism doesn't appeal to me at all. And though I didn't go looking for precursors to the present, they're all over the place there.
Now, looking at your bibliography overall, I'd say that you've been pretty ecumenical in the sort of path of American history that you've looked into, biographies, financial economic history, foreign affairs. And I'm just curious, and this is my last question for you, if you see yourself as having any mission as a historian. You know, you have a guy like, say, Robert Caro, who's trying to write the definitive biography of LBJ, or a guy like Bernard Lewis, who is trying to help the West understand Islam. And do you see yourself as having any kind of mission in that sense, or any kind of narrative that you're trying to create, or is it just one thing to the next is piquing your interest?
I got into the history business as a teacher, and I still teach. I've got a large class, a 300-student class of undergraduates at the University of Texas. And if there is any kind of mission to what I do, it's to extend my classroom. I write books not primarily anymore for academic specialists. You have to do that early in your academic career. But now I try to engage people who don't think they're interested in history. One of the reasons I write biographies, my biographies are actually histories in disguise. They're lives and times that include a lot of the times, more than a lot of other biographies. But I'm writing for people who think they don't like history. But if I can hook them, if I can bring them in, if I can get somebody who says, you know, I've always been interested in Grant. You know, history, no. Because a whole lot of people have a bad experience of history from high school, where there are some inspired and inspiring high school teachers, but there's just a lot that happens in high school that turns people off of history. So, but if I can, whether I do it with my students at the University of Texas or readers of my books, if I can remind them or convince them that history is interesting, then I do feel that I have succeeded at least in that regard. Because history, unlike, let's say, chemistry or physics, is a subject that anyone can teach himself or herself if you're interested. So what I try to do is kind of crook a finger and say, come on in, take a look. This is really interesting stuff. And if I can interest people, then I feel I've succeeded.
Well, that does sound like a good success rate. All right, well, thanks for talking to me. That was really interesting.
Okay, we're going to talk to you, Aiden.
All right, so that's the show. Thanks to you for listening, and a lot of thanks to HW Brands for taking the time out to speak with me. If you'd like to buy his new book, it's published by Doubleday and available in all of those bookbuying places you like to visit. If you'd like to check out his essay in our politics issue, you can pick it up for a few more days on the newsstands, and then our new issue, Intoxication, hits the stores. After that, you can purchase it as a back issue through our website, laphamsquarterly.org. And once you've looked at it, go back to the bookstore and buy Intoxication, which has great readings from people like Andy Warhol, King James, Harpo Marx, Omar Khayyam, Dennis Johnson, and Ernest Hemingway about the many joys and sorrows offered to us from the nefarious world of drugs and alcohol. But you could also subscribe to the magazine on our website, where you can also look at back issues, listen to old podcasts, read web-only content like our Deja Vu and Roundtable sections, and we're on all the social medias, Tumblr, Twitter, Facebook, just not Grindr. You can also follow me on Twitter, @FlaxClark. Anyway, until next time, thanks for downloading this episode of the Lapham's Quarterly Podcast. And if you liked it, make sure to leave us some positive feedback in the comments section of the iTunes Store.
Great stuff, huh? That is great stuff. You know, I got to tell you, you're not going to get the freshest for me here on Secular Sunday because, I'll tell you why. I'll be stepping on the brothers and sisters' toes. You need to go to the websites to get their freshest stuff. Latham's Quarterly is outstanding. Pricey, but outstanding. I hope you enjoy the show. Coming up, Frank Ellis on The Damned and the Dead, Soviet novelist during World War II. Very interesting. Coming up into the second hour. In the download zone, you'll get part 14 of 16 from Vox Libri, or LibriVox, excuse me, LibriVox readings of Sir Winston Churchill's The River Wars in the download zone. Mm-hmm.
Because I Could Not Stop for Death by Emily Dickinson, read for LibriVox.org by Anita Fleming. Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me. The carriage held but just ourselves and immortality. We slowly drove, he knew no haste, and I had put away my labor and my leisure too, for his civility. We passed the school where children played at wrestling in a ring. We passed the fields of gazing grain. We passed the setting sun. We passed before a house that seemed a swelling of the ground. The roof was scarcely visible, the cornice but a mound. Since then, 'tis centuries, but each feels shorter than the day I first surmised the horses' heads were toward eternity. End of poem. This recording is in the public domain.
The Stage Driver's Story, a poem by Bret Hart, from East West Poems. Read for LibriVox.org by Alan Davis Drake. It was the stage driver's story, as he stood with his back to the wheelers, quietly flecking his whip and turning his quid of tobacco, while on the dusty road, and blent with the rays of the moonlight, we saw the long curl of his lash, and the juice of tobacco descending. Danger. Sir, I believe you. Indeed, I may say on that subject, you your existence might put to the hazard and turn of a wager. I have seen danger? Oh, no. Not me, sir, indeed, I assure you. 'Twas only the man with the dog that is sitting alone in yon wagon. It was the Geiger grade, a mile and a half from the summit. Black as your hat was the night, and never a star in the heavens. Thundering down the grade, the gravel and stones we sent flying over the precipice side, 1,000 feet, plumb to the bottom. Halfway down the grade I felt, sir, a thrilling and creaking. Then a lurch to one side, as we hung on the bank of the canyon. Then, looking up the road, I saw, in the distance behind me, the hind wheel of the coach just loosed from its axle, and following. One glance alone I gave, then gathered together my ribbons, shouted and flung them outspread at the straining necks of my cattle, screamed at the top of my voice, and lashed the air in my frenzy, while down the Geiger grade on 3 wheels the vehicle thundered. Speed was our only chance, when again came the ominous rattle. Crack! And another wheel slipped away and was lost in the darkness. 2 only now were left. Yet, such was our fearful momentum, upright, erect, and sustained on 2 wheels, the vehicle thundered, as some huge boulder, unloosed from its rocky shelf on the mountain, drives before it the hare and the timorous squirrel, far leaping. So down the Geiger grade rushed the pioneer coach, and before it leaped the wild horses, and shrieked in advance of the danger impending. But to be brief in my tale, again, ere we came to level, slipped from its axle a wheel, so that, to be plain in my statement, a matter of 1,200 yards or more, as the distance may be, we traveled upon 1 wheel until we drove up to the station. Then, sir, we sank in a heap. But picking myself from the ruins, I heard a noise up the grade, and looking, I saw in the distance the 3 wheels following still, like moons on the horizon whirling, till, circling, they gracefully sank on the road at the side of the station. This is my story, sir, a trifle indeed, I assure you. Much more, perchance, might be said, but I hold him, of all men, most lightly who swerves from the truth in his tale. No, thank you. Well, since you're pressing, perhaps I don't care if I do. You may give me the same, Jim. No sugar. End of poem. This recording is in the public domain.
Cities of the Plain by Edgar Lee Masters. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Reading by Bologna Times. Where are the cabalists? The insidious committees, the panders who betrayed the idiot cities. For miles and miles toward the prairie sprawled, ignorant, soulless, rich, smothered in fumes of pitch. Rooms of mahogany in tall skyscrapers, see the unfolding and the folding up of ring-clipped papers and letters which keep drugged the public cup. The walls hear whispers and the semitones of voices in the corner over telephones muffled by Persian padding, gemmed with brass spittoons. Butts of cigars are on the glass-topped table, and through the smoke, gracing the furtive Babel, the bishop's picture blesses the picaroons, who start or stop the life of millions moving, unconscious of obedience, the plastic yielders to satanic and dynastic hands of reproaching and approving. Here come knights armed, but their arms concealed and rubber-heeled. Here priests and wavering want are charmed, and shadows fall here like the sharks in messages received or sent. Signals are flying from the battlement, and every president of rail, gas, coal, and oil, the parks, the receipt of custom knows, without a look, their meaning as the code is in no book. The treasonous cracksmen of the city's wealth watch for the flags of stealth. Acres of coal lie fenced along the tracks. Tracks ribbon the streets, and beneath the streets, wires for voices, fire, thwart the plebiscites, and choke the councils and symposiacs of dreamers who have pity for the backs that bear and bleed. All things are theirs. Tracks, wires, streets, and coal, the church's creed, the city's soul, the city's sea-girt loveliness, the merciless and meretricious press. Far up in a watchtower where the news is printed, gray faces and bright eyes, weary and cynical, discuss fresh wonders of the old cabal, but nothing of its work in type is hinted. Taxes are high. The mentors of the town must keep their taxes down on buildings, presses, stocks, in gas, oil, coal, and docks. The mahogany rooms conceal a Spider-Man who holds the taxing bodies through the church and knights with arms concealed. The mentors search the Spider-Man, the master publican, and for his friendship silence keep, letting him herd the populace like sheep, for self and for the insatiable desires of coal and tracks and wires, pick judges, legislators, and tax-gatherers, or name his favorites, whom they name, the slick and sinistral servitors of the cabal, for praise which seems the equivalent of fame, giving to the delicate-handed crackers of priceless safes, the spiritual slackers, the flash and thunder of front pages, and the gold millions stare and fling their wages where they are bidden, helpless and emasculate, and the unilluminate whose brows are brass, who weep on every Sabbath day for Jesus riding on an ass, scarce know the ass is they, now ridden by his effigy, the publican with Jesus' painted mask, along a way where fumes of odorless gas first spur, then fell them from the task. Through the parade runs swift the psychic cackle, like thorns beneath a boiling pot that crackle, and the angels say to Yahweh looking down from the alabaster railing on the town, "Oh, cackle, 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 crack and crack, we wish we had our little Sodom back." End of poem. This recording is in the public domain.
thank you for joining us for another installment of New Books in Military History. With me today is Frank Ellis. He's the author of The Damned and the Dead, The Eastern Front Through the Eyes of Soviet and Russian Novelists. And this came out with the University of Kansas, Press of Kansas, one of the premier publishers of military history, in 2011. Frank, thank you for joining me today.
Well, thank you very much indeed for inviting me on. It's a real pleasure.
What we'd like to do is to get you to introduce yourself briefly and then talk about how you came to write this book about Russian war novels.
Okay, it's quite an interesting story, actually. I think it is. Maybe you'll read it, your listeners might disagree. But I served in the military. I was in the Airborne and Special Forces for 13 years. That's the parachute regiment in Britain. You'd call it 101st Airborne or 82nd Airborne in the US. And I also served in the British Special Air Service, which is the British equivalent of the SEALs and Special Forces Green Berets. And one of the areas in which I specialized in during the Cold War was the National People's Army of East Germany and the Soviet military stationed inside East Germany. And one of our primary missions would have been during a Warsaw Pact attack on West Germany, would have been to attack the Soviet main supply routes coming through East Germany. And I used to spend a lot of time studying the terrain, the topography, with a view to promoting what one hoped would have been some effective ambushes on their supply lines, and also attacking and killing their divisional headquarters staff as well to break down, disrupt command and control. So having left the military, my sort of interests really were very academic, and so a university post was what beckoned, and I taught for a year at the University of Las Vegas. I did Russian and German there, and then I taught at British University, University of Leeds. And then I left that, and I'm now a completely freelance independent researcher. And I've always had this interest in the war literature side as well. It's not just the Soviet-Russian war literature, but also German. Americans got some very good stuff as well, some excellent stuff. And so it seemed to me that this was an area in Russian studies which really required a serious attempt to look at it. Because for one very obvious reason, hardly anybody had looked at it. And really, this is quite an amazing gap in Soviet-Russian studies. Quite remarkable indeed, that given that this literature has been, well, really around since 1941 onwards, and is still being produced even now, it is quite remarkable that there has not been, over this period, until my book was published in 2011, a single monograph devoted almost entirely to this subject. Quite remarkable. So that's really where I've come from.
And is this true in Russian as well?
No, it's not. No. Russians, of course, have published a great deal of material on this. It still is a major theme. Throughout the Cold War, it was certainly the case, but it's also a battlefield as well, because one of the problems of Soviet-Russian literature is it's not just the war theme. It was subjected to a ferocious regime of censorship from 1918 onwards, in which it was only formally abolished on the 1st of August 1990, when Gorbachev signed into law the first, as it was then, it was still Soviet press law, which outlawed prior censorship. Up until then, censorship was a huge problem. And war writers, given the extreme sensitivity of the theme in the Soviet Union, war writers were subjected to all kinds of censorship as well. And so what you had here was another battle going on between the censors and indeed the writers. And I suppose the most famous example of this, the most infamous example, I wrote the first English language study of Vasily Grossman, who wrote that remarkable Stalingrad novel, Life and Fate. And what happened to him, I suppose, really explains the problem very nicely. Grossman was a war correspondent for Red Star, which is the Soviet military newspaper. He covered the Battle of Stalingrad for about 4 to 5 months. And he wrote all kinds of really, really good articles, actually, for the Red Star. And then after the war, he wrote part one of what was to be a two-part novel devoted to the battle. Part one was called For a Just Cause. And a lot of people have dismissed it as a kind of a Stalinist conformist novel. It's clearly nothing of the sort. But after Stalin died, and Khrushchev's partial denunciation of Stalin in 1956, Grossman got down to writing the sequel, Life and Fate. Now, Grossman actually did believe, and this is quite remarkable, he really did believe that it would be possible for this novel to be published in the Soviet Union. And it's a remarkable novel. Have you read it by any chance?
No.
Oh, right, okay, right.
Is it available in English?
There is a good English translation of it. And it, I think how well it's sold in the US, I don't know. It sold remarkably well in Germany when it came out, in German translation in 1984. It did very well in Italy, very well in France. Didn't do well. I don't think it did so well over here either, for reasons which I don't fully understand. But the point is of this novel is that one of the highlights in the novel is an interrogation scene between an SS officer and a Bolshevik commissar, and the SS officer says to the commissar that you and I are not enemies. You and I are really mirror images of one. We are reflections of one another. Our real enemy are the liberal democracies. And today we're killing the Jews in the name of a perfected society, and you killed the kulaks in the 30s. But you and I will learn from one another. So if one of us loses the war, then we will live on in your victory and vice versa. Well, this is, you know, when Suslov, who's the chief ideologue of the Communist Party, the manuscript was seized by the KGB. They turned up at Grossman's flat, arrested the manuscript. They left Grossman alone. And Grossman tried to get the manuscript back, returned, and he went to see Suslov. And Suslov told him that your novel, Dr. Zhivago, the scandal with Dr. Zhivago, had only just finished in 1960. Zhivago got the Nobel Prize, Pasternak got the Nobel Prize, sorry. And Suslov told Grossman that Dr. Zhivago was a stinking little weed compared to your book. Your book is an atomic bomb. Were it published, it would destroy the Soviet Union. Now, the really interesting thing about this meeting is that Suslov then told Grossman, maybe your novel will be published in about 300 years' time. Well, it was published in 1988. It was one of the major publication events of the Glasnost period when the novel was first published, and truly remarkable. So that's an example of the censorship. Now, that's a spectacular example, but there are many, many other examples of where writers have had their works more or less butchered and hacked to pieces by the censorship apparatus in order to get them into the public domain or published in the Soviet journals. Good example would be Kuznetsov's book called Babi Yar. Babi Yar is the it literally means in Russian grandmother's ravine. Well, it was a site of a mass murder of Jews in September 1941. About 35,000 were subjected to death by mass machine gunning. And Kuznetsov was wrote about this in the novel, and the novel was censored, cut to pieces, and eventually he defected to this country in, I think, about 65 or 66. So these are some of the better-known examples of censorship, but they're the ones that have hit the headlines in the West. But outside of these examples, there are plenty more of writers who've waged a non-stop battle to get some kind of non-conformist, non-ideologically acceptable view of the war into print. And I think they've been quite successful. I really do. Some of them have. The censors were not. They certainly tried very hard to suppress all kinds of unwelcome truths and insights about the war. And they had success, but they didn't have it all their own way, it has to be said.
What am I correct in reading into this that that there's a certain irony to the fact that it's in precisely war novels, which can, they don't always, or maybe even usually, but can certainly celebrate the regime and promote patriotism, were locations where surprising levels of dissent were able to sneak through.
Yes, I think there is something to be said to that as well. And the other problem, of course, is that the war, you see, one of the problems about the great fatherland war, the great patriotic war, is that it wasn't just a war between two totalitarian regimes. You see, the trouble is, one of the big problems about the war was that it reopened wounds which, well, maybe they've not never really been closed in the first place. One of the central themes, for example, in Vasil Buikov's literature, Vasil Buikov is I think probably the outstanding exponent of this theme in all Soviet Russian letters, not a Russian, of course, a Belarusian. But one of the central themes in all of his works, be it the small unit sub-stories or the partisan warfare, is the way in which mass collectivization comes back to haunt the regime when the Germans invaded. You have to bear in mind that the Ukrainians have a word for this now. They call it Holodomor, which means mass death by starvation. And during the 1930s, Stalin collectivized the entire agriculture of the Ukraine and the Baltics and the Belarusian, mainly Ukraine. And it led to some minimum of 6 million dead in the starvation famine, the terror famine, as Robert Conquest called it, and probably another 4 million, maybe 5 million dying of hypothermia, disease, insurrections, deportations to Siberia. And it's an astonishing event. And, of course, those survivors of this, when the Germans came with promises of abolishing the collective farms, this was a huge and effective recruiting sergeant for the German army. And it's a major theme in virtually all of Buyukov's works. And indeed, Grossman picks up on this as well. So what appears to be just a war between National Socialist Germany and the Soviet Union is, in fact, a whole series of wars and disputes and bitter conflicts going on, all interacting with one another, all changing people's loyalties according to the change of the military situation. So it makes the whole picture, quite, in some respects, quite a complicated picture.
I was struck too, as both as an American citizen and a scholar of Germany, the way in which national literatures are constrained and constrained by the kind of national mythology about the war. So, in other words, a dissenting view in the Soviet Union, a victor country, but one where this is, you know, with this totalitarian society versus what would constitute maybe a dissenting or an anti-war novel in the United States, a victor country, but a freer society, versus Germany, loser of the war, where drawing that distinction between the regime that fought the war and the protagonist of the novel was in some ways essential to establishing that kind of mythology that the war literature was building.
Mm. Yes, one of the problems is there's no doubt. First of all, the Soviet party, the Soviet state apparatus, tried very hard and to co-opt the war for its own purposes. The war was the victory of Marxism, Leninism over fascism, as they often incorrectly refer to the Nazis. It was the victory of the Soviet system over the Nazi system, and also during the context of the Cold War. Post-1946 in Churchill's Fulton, Missouri speech, it was also a victory over all forms of capitalism as well. The real problem is that I think about the war literatures of the various belligerent states. For America, I don't think the war literature really is a huge problem in terms of argument. For most Americans, it was a job that had to be done. It's business as usual. The war is a part of World War II. That is a part of America's history, which Americans celebrate and remember. But you know, it clearly doesn't feature to anywhere near the same extent as it does in Russia, for obvious reasons in terms of the millions of casualties and devastation. That's clear. Britain, again, I think probably had a good war in terms of the way it sees itself. The Germans, it's quite interesting now what's happening in Germany. It seems to me because. You only have to look at I can only describe it as an outcry, which accompanied the publication of Günter Grass's most recent novel, In Krebsgang, in 2002. The idea that Germans here can never be permitted to be victims, they can only be seen as perpetrators and evildoers, I think this causes an enormous intellectual stress in German society today. It really does. The facts of the matter, and also it's not... I mean, the sinking of the Wilhelm Gustloff, was a terrible thing that happened, and the people who died in it were innocents. They were not concentration camp guards. You look at Jörg Friedrich's book, for example, on the RAF bombing campaign of German cities. You know, nearly a million Germans were killed in this campaign as well. Dresden, I've just come back from Dresden. I was in Dresden earlier this month, and... You know, I look at the Frauenkirche and I look at the city, and I, you know, having served in the military, I think, I have to tell you, I feel a sense of, maybe just the odd shimmer of guilt here, thinking, did we really cause 35,000 deaths in this city on Fashing Tuesday in 45? And yes, we did. And you begin to think, my God, this did happen. This is total war. Then the Germans, of course... The other parts of the Germans suffering at the end of the war is that all the Germans being dispossessed and driven out of their ancient homelands in Czechoslovakia, Czech Republic, huge parts of Poland. You know, Germans did suffer. I mean, the mass rape of German women, most infamously, of course, in Berlin, but it happened all over East Prussia. And Germans somehow You sense in Germany today that Germans, even now in 2012, it's somehow not quite respectable to talk about this, and certainly not to see Germans as victims. Germans, there seems to be a stratum in German society, and it's not just the Germans. I think the British are quite guilty here as well, who want to impose permanently on Germany that you were the perpetrators, and therefore the idea that you were in any possible sense victims is simply not possible and somehow morally dubious. It's a way almost of trying to downplay the crimes of the Nazi regime.
Yeah, well, you're treading dangerous ground there. You'll get me talking about Germany too much, but I don't know if you were in Dresden before they reconstructed the Frauenkirche during the Cold War.
No, I wasn't actually. No, during the Cold War period, no, I wasn't. No.
You weren't invited in anyway, right?
No.
But they, of course, it was left as rubble by the East German regime, and there was
prominently placed
in front of it. As a Mahnmal, which is that peculiar German word, it's like a warning memorial to I forget the exact phrasing, but it was something about capitalist aggression.
Basically the regime, the Socialist Unity Party, clearly exploited it for their own particular purposes as well. So, you know, war memorials, of course, are very vulnerable to this. There's no doubt about that at all. You know, any regime or whatever political color can exploit them for its own ends, and that clearly does happen, no doubt about that.
Well, so, I mean, you talk about an enormous number of novels, and you've emphasized life and fate among them. Are there others? I mean, I'm almost thinking about maybe spinning this off as a kind of discussion on the New Book Network about Russian war novels in translation, or maybe a compare Krebsgang with Life and Fate or something like that.
Would be kind of interesting. Well, the trouble is, you see, this is a problem. A lot of Russian war novels are simply not available in English translation. This is the problem, number one. And some of the ones that were translated during World War II and immediately after are not particularly good translations anyway. So there is a problem there straight away. Grossman's Life and Fate has been translated. His other major Stalingrad novel, For a Just Cause, Za Pravye Delo, in Russian, has not been translated. You've got the major war novel by Viktor Astafiev, which was published in the early 90s, The Damned and the Dead, Proklatie Ubiti. That's not been translated, and I'm not aware that anybody's planning to translate it. It's a remarkable war novel. My God, that is an amazing war novel. And some of his other works as well, none of those have been translated into English. And then the other writer some of his works have been translated, but again, the translations are not particularly good, is Vasil Buikov. And he is a truly outstanding writer. And his novels cover his short stories, Povesti, they cover the period basically from 1959 right up to he died in 2003. He was still writing about 2001, 2002. And his novels are truly remarkable. They really are absolutely amazing stuff. So there's that. You've also got, I'm not quite certain whether the general in his army, the General Evil Army by Georgi Vadimov, I'm not quite certain whether that's been translated. I've only read it in the Russian. But all of these are major works dealing with the war. And also, they're particularly with Viktor Astafiev, because he's writing in the 1990s, and the same with Georgi Vadimov, who had his novel published in 1994. These are novels written after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and so the question of censorship, discoloring them and disfiguring them, doesn't arise in any way at all. So it's very interesting to read these novels as well. They are remarkable. For example, the General's Army deals with this theme. Its critical theme is the collaboration theme in General Vlasov, and this is a really bitterly contested theme in Russia today. The question of Andrei Vlasov's collaboration with the Germans.
So, and it must be the case that even if the censorship law changes, there are still issues facing these novelists. I mean, whether stemming from the Putin regime itself or just from the general social atmosphere that determines
there are pressures to conform, and you can send, yeah, and authors are, well, Vladimir, of course, is now dead, but and also at the time he wrote this novel, he was a literary exile living in Germany. He'd been forced to leave during the Cold War. So he was regarded by some of the mainstream critics living in Russia still as a kind of a literary Vlasovite himself, a sort of a literary traitor, and therefore, a fair game. But yes, there are there are pressures on these writers and social pressures. But you know, the censorship, the KGB or the FSB are not going to come along and arrest them. And it all, the other thing as well, which needs to be said here, and due tribute must be paid to the FSB itself. Which is the Federalная Служба Безопасности. This is a successor body to the KGB. This organization has done, has made enormous, massive contributions to uncovering, exposing, declassifying hitherto totally top secret documents. Absolutely remarkable what this organization has done. For example, the series, they've got this series going, it's nearly complete now, it may actually be complete, called the Agencies of State Security During World War II. And each year of the war has got two volumes dedicated to it. There's part one, which covers January, June, and then July to December. And every year of the war has got these two volumes. Well, these volumes are packed, jammed, solid with declassified documents, most of them Savrashina Sekretna, top secret docs, which have been totally declassified and organized under sections, and the entire documents are published in Russian. And it's an amazing collection of stuff. It really is amazing. And the quality of presentation, the scholarship is simply outstanding. And I have to tell you as well, here's another thing as well on the censorship issue. I wrote to President Putin about, let me see now, would have been about 8 years ago when he was president the last time round. And I wrote to him and I asked for access to a specific archive. I got no reply, but I know the letter was delivered because we sent it by a postal delivery service and his office had to sign for it. Well, I got no reply, but I turned up in Moscow at the archive of the Lubyanka, the former KGB headquarters, an ominous building in terms of Soviet and Russian history. I had an interview with the archivist, and he gave me the complete interrogation files of five German officers who had been arrested at Stalingrad at the end of January 1943. Okay, now these officers have been responsible for running very few people even know about this camp. It's called Dulag 205. Dulag in German means Durchgangslager. It's a transit camp. Well, this camp held about 2.5, maybe as many as 4,000 Soviet prisoners of war. And from October 1942, as the winter came in with a vengeance, up until January the 31st, 1943, when the camp was overrun by the Russians, the total death toll was about 3,000 Soviet prisoners of war died. Cannibalism was rife. There were arbitrary shootings and executions. Well, these officers were all arrested and subjected to about an 18-month period of interrogations, and eventually handed over to Smirsch after April 1943. And anyway, put in front of a military tribunal, tried as war criminals, found guilty, and executed. Well, I was given access to all of their files, all their interrogation files in both German and Russian. And I wrote a very long article about this, which was published in the Journal of Slavic Military Studies. I think it was in March of 2006. So anybody interested in it could follow this up. It'll be obviously in your library in the U.S., and it's an amazing. It was amazing to have. I got access to this material. Quite astonishing. The files in the archive reading room when I went in there was it must have been about 5 feet of A4 folders just piled up. It took me nearly 8 or 9 days to sort of read to get through the stuff. You know, just so much of it. Remarkable account. And so I think there is a. It's not all doom and gloom on this censorship by any means. No, I think that I detect a huge willingness now on the part of I nearly said the Soviet system. I've got to stop saying it. You get so used to saying Soviet, don't you? I detect a huge willingness on the part of a number of Russian federal agencies to open up and talk about the war. Some are still fairly sensitive. But I have to tell you that when I go there and I ask, would it be possible to have access to this, 9 times out of 10, I have not been turned down at all. No, I haven't. So I can only speak for myself personally, but I have had fairly good access to the material I require. So I detect, this suggests to me that there is a willingness to open this stuff up. The one set of archive material that I'd like to see opened up, which as far as I'm aware is still under lock and key, is all the interrogation reports dealing with Andrei Vlasov when he was captured in 45 and then eventually executed along with many of his fellow officers.
I take it, or maybe I'm assuming, that this is part of the subject matter of this other publication that's mentioned in the materials with this book, about the Russia's infosphere.
That was another one. What I was dealing with there was the effect, one of my central ideas in that book was the idea that censorship destroyed the Soviet Union. I believe that censorship, basically I coined this term of information deficit, and it is my opinion that censorship, when particularly, see, the Soviet Union believed that it could control all flows of information, and ultimately, you can't completely, but by so doing, you destroy the flows of information to the people who need it most, and therefore your whole technological base starts to suffer. As I think I argued, it's all well and good. It's no good being able to steal the latest computer secrets from Microsoft and all the software if you're not prepared to permit the diffusion of PCs in your own society. It's no good having Xerox photocopiers under wrap and key or stealing all the secrets from Xerox or whatever the latest or Hewlett-Packard, and then not permitting people. The benefits of information technology only accrue when the benefits of technology are allowed to be enjoyed by everybody in the society, not just the secret police and the government agencies. And ultimately, I believe that censorship was a critical factor in bringing the whole system down. And it wasn't just so much the censorship of literature, of war literature, the village prose, literature generally, but also scientists as well. If you can't access the latest journals from published in the United States or Britain or Germany and share your results, you're not going to get the critical mass of ideas. Money alone won't work. I mean, the Soviets put billions of dollar equivalents into these scientific towns. They had this town in Siberia, didn't they, called Akademik Gorodok, Akademichesky Gorodok, Academic City. Money wasn't a problem, but if you can't talk about if you can't ask what if questions and go beyond the limits of ideology, then effectively all the money in the world isn't going to help you progress. So I think that censorship is a critical factor here. But it's certainly nothing like the censorship that you have in Russia now is nothing of the order compared to what existed prior to 1991. Nowhere near it.
So it's the antithesis of that remark made to Grossman about his book being an atomic bomb.
It was censorship
of his book that insidiously digs away at the system.
Yes, it is. And it's not just Grossman as well. It's people like Vasil Buikov as well and all these other writers digging away, like constantly, gnawing away all the time at the system, you know, and the constant speculation as well. People are raising all these awkward questions, and it just goes on and on and on and on. And the other thing I think which is really interesting about what happened to the Soviet Union, Gorbachev opened up the Soviet Union he liberalized the press and the media from 85 onwards, and he opened up the Soviet Union precisely at the moment when all these new IT media, faxes, email, and personal computers were starting to become a big, big factor. And this meant that he opened up the Soviet Union at the moment of maximum internal weakness in terms of discussion of ideas. And he rather naively believed that if you let all these writers publish their books of Life and Fate, Dr. Zhivago, and all the forbidden ones that were stamped on throughout the Soviet period, we, for example, Yevgeny Zamyatin's We, Andrei Platonov's Kotlovan, if you allowed them to publish all these books, the pressure for reform would go and the system could survive. Well, that's not what happened. Once the floodgates of censorship once the censorship apparatus was effectively prevented from functioning and anything became possible more or less to openly to discuss, that was the end of the system. Could not possibly survive that kind of internal scrutiny and indeed external scrutiny as well. It was finished, and I think that's what really finished, broke the system in the end. Gorbachev didn't realize it. He thought he was going to protect the system, make some concessions, but of course by making these concessions, which he did, and he deserves credit for making them, he more or less accelerated the final demise of the entire system all over Eastern Europe.
Well, this is it's a fascinating topic, and maybe I should go on and read that book as well. Let's talk a little bit more about the war novels. A couple of issues that struck me, or a couple of themes that struck me, were the kinds of events that these writers that you're considering stress. You know, in the United States, there are these iconic events, Pearl Harbor and D-Day and the Battle of the Bulge. And so
well, Iwo Jima would be a big one in America, surely.
Oh, Iwo Jima.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I've seen that memorial two or three times, and I'm English, and I tell you what, it touches me very deeply, I have to say. It's an astonishing memorial. It's just an amazing memorial. And the whole back of the Bill of Jean itself is just truly astounding. But those Navy corpsmen, those Marines, putting that flag up on Mount Suribachi, it's just it's a remarkable memorial. It really is truly remarkable.
But so, of course, there are these Soviet corollaries. And one of the things that, I mean, I guess it's not surprising when you're setting up these authors and they're pointing out their dissenting viewpoints, but that the summer of 41 is the setting for so many of the events that they depict, that chaotic summer. And the difficulty of managing a description of this incredible, what looks like a devastating defeat from day one, in the context of censorship, to be able to even discuss those events.
I think it's totally impossible. Whatever the writer tries to depict, he's simply going to come up against one major obstacle: events. The sheer nature of the catastrophe, however ideologically orthodox a writer was, simply could not be glossed over. It was impossible. Absolutely impossible. And people, you know, Russians became very, well, not just Russians, Ukrainians, Belarusians, and all the rest of them, they became extremely adept at reading between the lines. It was impossible. It was a thankless task. And the only way, really, the regime could deal with it in terms of the propaganda was simply to, you know, promote the notion of heroic resistance and hope that something like that actually happened on the ground. But in trying to deal with the problem, you know, it was impossible. It was an impossible task, and one that clearly I can't think of any writer that managed to deal with. I mean, the way to deal with it is you have to deal with a particular rather than with the whole global picture. So, for example, Grossman tries to deal with it in one of his first wartime novels, The People Are Immortal. Narod Bessmertin, he deals with that there. Simonov deals through the medium of poetry. The poetry became very important in this early part of the war as well, because it was a way of concentrating the emotions. And, of course, by nature of poetry, it avoided some of the concrete things which would more normally fall to the novelist rather than to the poet. So that was an effective way of getting around that. But the real sort of, it's always a mark of a regime's, you tend to find a willingness to concede that things weren't as good as they should have been only from the standpoint of, say, a looming victory, or the sense that, yes, okay, we've still got some way to go, but the worst is over, we've turned the corner. And you can find some of that in some of the later stories in early 43. But certainly the early ones, it's all about 41, 42, it's all about promoting this idea of implacable resistance. The Grossman Stalingrad reporting is full of this sort of stuff as well. And then some of the later stuff, there's a hint of, yes, okay, reading between the lines, we weren't as well prepared as we should have been, but, you know, we're in a stronger position now, so it's easy to make concessions from a position of strength when your, you know, back's against the wall and total death and destruction appears to be upon you. You're not really much in the mood for making concessions to, well, we're not doing a particularly good job, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, that's a tactic that German authors use, I think, also to emphasize victimization, is to pull into that tight shot of the soldier in the trench under bombardment and so forth, that kind of obliterates any need to discuss the political
context. I think this is precisely what happens, in, for example, in Gerlach's novel, Die Verratene Armee, and also in Das Geduldige Fleisch. Both of those, you see that theme as well. Well, of course, Verratene Armee is a Stalingrad novel, but Das Geduldige Fleisch is post-Stalingrad. But then it's all about trying to save the West from Bolshevism, which rather conveniently ignores the fact that it was the Germans who invaded the Soviet Union.
A continuation of Nazi propaganda. That was the shift that Himmler himself made late in the war, to try to depict the defense of Germany as this necessary project.
Yes, exactly.
So you also, I think, emphasize, at least in a few points, the similarities of kind of war novels across nationalities in terms of the discussion of the common soldier. And are there any of those kind of themes that you'd like to emphasize?
Yes, indeed, because I think that when you look at one of the problems I've always had with certain Western critics of Russian war literature is that they somehow seem surprised when they encounter honest concessions made by Russian writers that Soviet soldiers were guilty of cowardice, there was executions for cowardice and so on, there was desertion. Because that rather suggests to me that they had tended to accept possibly the Soviet view that Soviet soldiers were somehow different. And it seems to me that would be completely against what human experience tells us. I mean, any reading of war going back to the history of the Peloponnesian War, for example, right up until, well, now in 2012, clearly shows that cowardice, heroism, self-sacrifice, and terrible suffering are the permanent givens in war literature. And therefore, any war literature which seeks to deny these things is really is telling us that there's a new type of person being created or a new type of psychology being created, when all the evidence would clearly suggest that it's absolutely not the case at all. So here we can see the pernicious influence of ideology on war literature. And I think also the fact that a number of Western critics have been surprised by this tells me that maybe in some way they have tended implicitly to accept the Soviet view, the Soviet portrayal of their own soldiers in this literature.
Well, I couldn't help. I haven't read the novels, but I've seen a couple of the movies, and so I couldn't help resisting. I have a copy of the movie Star.
Oh, yeah, that's Star, oh, yes. Oh, yes, now this is an amazing story, yeah. Zvezda in Russian. Yes, it's an amazing story. What do you think of the actual film itself?
Well, I haven't watched it yet, and part of the reason is I believe my copy is not subtitled, and so I was sort of holding out to see if I could find one that was subtitled.
Ah, right. No, I've not. It's been made. It's been filmed, I think, a couple of times, and there is a very recent version of it as well. I think about 2001 or 2002. Have you read the story itself, the short story?
No.
No. Right. Okay. It's a very much an anomalous novel, that is, or short story, because it appears in 1946, right after the war, right at the height of the post-war anti-Semitic purges. These are the Zhdanovshchina, and it's a remarkable story. And it really, if you change the names and change the protagonists and got rid of all the German-Soviet sort of conflict, it could be a story of a reconnaissance patrol going on anywhere in any conflict. It is truly remarkable. And the other thing that makes it very interesting as well is the supernatural element in it, which I find particularly interesting as well. And there is a war film which has this as well, called The Keep, with that German actor,
yeah, Jürgen
Prochnow, now. That's quite good. That's an element of the supernatural in that as well. And more recently, it's a sort of black comedy. There's that Dog Soldiers, which came out in 2002. But Star
Wars... Yvonne's childhood has these moments where these kind of dreamy scenes. Does that qualify as well? I'm casting back to some vague memories.
You mean Ivanova Dietzra, Ivan's Childhood by Tarkovsky? Yes. Well, again, Bogomolov, again, a very, very good war writer as well. But Star is a remarkable short story. I really do, and it also deals with this theme of that you've got this supernatural element as well in the sense that the soldier, the scout who takes the horses and uses them for money-making purposes and then doesn't return them, somehow, in some way, he is guilty of bringing on the final death and destruction on this reconnaissance patrol behind the lines. Yes, it's a remarkable story, that is, Kazakevich's Star. Very, very good.
You have a good analysis of it in your book. The other one is that I saw first years ago on an old VHS copy that a colleague had made while living in Japan, so it was in Russian with Japanese subtitles, and
okay,
I still enjoyed it, and that was Lark, and I won't try the Russian.
Oh, the Lark, the Zhavrnik in Russian.
Where they steal the German, the prisoners of war steal the German tank and roam the countryside.
No, it's not one I've, I have to say, it's not one I've seen, I must confess. Some of these small, some of these short stories which have just dropped under the radar, they have some really interesting themes in them. There's no question about that at all. Nekrasov's In the Trenches of Stalingrad is another remarkable novel, given that it was also published in 1946. It won a Stalin Prize, for God's sake. It's astonishing. And of course, later Nekrasov, as it defected to the West, ended up in Paris. I remember I didn't meet him, but I managed to write to him a few times, and we had an exchange of letters upon this theme of remarkism, because he was accused of being a remarkist writer. And so I wrote to him and said, could you explain to me what you think it means by it? We had quite an interesting exchange, actually, on this. It was very, very useful for me to be able to talk to him as well, or write to him, I should say.
Well, can you tell me a little bit about what you're working on now, if anything?
Yes, I can. I've just my latest book is on Stalingrad, because this year is the 70th anniversary of the Battle of Stalingrad, And the latest book is, the manuscript went off to University of Kansas Press earlier this year, or in fact it was in July. It's about 200,000 words, and the title, I think we've agreed on, if I can, we've had some chopping and changing, is The Stalingrad Cauldron, Inside the Encirclement and Destruction of German Sixth Army. And the book is likely to be out, I think, in April of next year. Now, this is based upon a huge amount of archive material, which I've got from German archives and indeed Soviet archives, and it covers basically there's a very detailed overview of the problems of weather and terrain and exhaustion. Then I've got some translations of memoirs from the 16th Panzer Division, 94th Infantry Division, and 76th Infantry Division. I've got a very detailed chapter on the snipers on the Eastern Front, particularly the great deal of attention paid to the so-called duel which took place between Zaitsev and Koenigs in Stalingrad.
Right.
Then I've got a chapter on Soviet deserters working inside the pocket, Soviet espionage rings behind the German lines run by the NKVD, the problem of German prisoners, and then the detailed discussion of the memoir of a German officer who spent 13 years in captivity, and then returned to Germany and wrote a very detailed account of it. Nobody's ever discussed this book before, and I've got a detailed discussion of that. And then I've got a final chapter on the theme of reconciliation. So it's really good. I'm very pleased with it. It's taken a lot of work, and it's now safely located with the publisher, and it'll now follow the normal production schedule. So it's very interesting. But Stalingrad, I mean, is an amazing theme as well in its own right, I have to tell you. There's some very interesting questions which are still to be resolved about Stalingrad as well. Should I mention some of those?
Yes, please,
Okay, one of the things here that really interests me is, first of all, the question of this duel between Zaitsev and Koenigs. It seems to me that the Russians themselves could answer this question quite easily, because in Zaitsev's memoir, Zaitsev wrote a memoir about this, well, not just about that, it was called Beyond the Volga, There's No Land, No Land For Us. Well, he mentions that when, after he had shot Koenigs dead, they waited until it got dark and recovered the body and the ID documents and handed them over to the divisional commander. Well, those ID documents would be extremely valuable proof as to, well, they would certainly support the story of the duel. And as far as I'm aware, they've never been placed in the public domain. So the Russian authorities, if they actually do have these ID documents of Koenigs, would be in a position to say, well, here they are, and put them in the public domain, and so far they've not. The other thing that interests me as well is we know, for example, I have looked at German archive records, ration returns from Sixth Army, and one of the things that emerges here is that there is probably at the peak, there's about 35,000 Soviet soldiers working for the Germans inside the pocket as so-called Hilfsmilliger, not to be confused with Zugeteilter, attached. They have different categories. So the question here is, what did actually happen to these soldiers after the German surrender? Now, Anthony Beaver speculates, and not unreasonably, that they were simply shot on sight by the NKVD and other Soviet agencies. That possibility, I think, can't be ruled out. But I actually got hold of the 10th NKVD archives in Moscow, and the extent material of this archive, of this division, there is nothing in there at all dealing with this problem, mainly because most of the archive was destroyed in a fire, I think, in 47 or 48. But what's particularly interesting here, one couldn't rule out a mass execution, a Katyn-style execution of all these men. But I tend to the view to think that most of them were subjected to this lengthy process of filtration. Are you clear what I mean by filtration?
Not exactly.
Okay, well, filtration was the method. It was a standard method used by the NKVD and Smirsch. So when, for example, Soviet soldiers who'd been captured by the Germans were recovered by their own side, or when Soviet civilians who'd lived under German occupation for any length of time were once again within the ambit of Soviet power, they were all subjected to a lengthy process of interrogations. And the NKVD, the Russian word for this is filtratsia. The idea was, in a sieve, and the sieve gets finer and finer and finer. So basically, you're winnowing out the ones that have simply just been surrendered or captured for no fault of their own. And what you're trying to do is to look for the ones who potentially were active collaborators, may even be Soviet or German state-hide agents. And so this process of filtration went on and on and on. Now, I do know, because some of the documents I've looked at show that there were camps set up, something in the region of 10,000 of what the Russians called former Soviet soldiers. They use this interesting, they use this word briefshire, they call them the former. And what happened, I suspect would have happened, is that they would have been interrogated precisely because they were regarded as a valuable reservoir of intelligence information by the NKVD. So rather than shooting them on the spot, they would have been interrogated to glean as much useful information from them as possible. Then, having gone through that process, they would have been subjected to one of three outcomes, it seems to me. Execution is possible. Some of them were executed. The more egregious cases of collaboration were punished with the death penalty. A second option was that they were sent to forced labor camps. And the other option, of course, they were sent to penal companies and penal battalions, where they would then, to use the standard Stalinist expression, be made to expiate their guilt by paying in their own blood, which is the standard expression that the Russians used. But the point is, I'm speculating here, and until such time as the Russian federal authorities publish explicit information on this, it remains one of those areas of Stalingrad which is not entirely crystal clear. The other area of Stalingrad, which I still think has still not been properly resolved, as far as I can tell, is just how many Soviet soldiers were executed under the provisions of Order 227. Now, John Erickson, he speculates, and he admits he's speculating. He actually reckons that as many as 13,500 soldiers in the 62nd Army alone were executed on Chuikov's orders, which I find a remarkably high figure, because if that kind of level of execution was replicated throughout all the armies making up the Stalingrad Front, the Don Front, and the Southwest Front, you would have execution deaths on Stalingrad in the Stalingrad zone of operations alone, running maybe into, well, let's see, maybe 50, 60,000 executions. Well, no army can function on that level of execution. So this is another question that really does need to be clarified once and for all. How many Red Army soldiers were executed by their own side? Okay, because at the moment I've got my own personal view based upon some of the data that I've had access to, some of in the public domain, some not in the public domain, suggests to me that the total number is considerably lower than 13,500 on all fronts. But it's an uncertainty. And the other question I'd like to have cleared up over Stalingrad as well is how many German soldiers actually deserted to the Soviet side? Because I've not seen any published figures on this at all. And one of the reasons why there probably are no published data on this is because the number of German soldiers who deserted to the Russian side or the Soviet side was probably very, very small by comparison with the number of Soviets who deserted to the Germans. And as a consequence, publishing the full data set merely rather makes an embarrassing comparison from the Russian contemporary Russian point of view. But there are some of the areas which are still not, as far as I can tell, have been properly resolved in terms of evidence and data.
Well, fascinating. I normally ask the interviewees at the end of the interview to give me some ideas for other new books to feature. I think in your case, I'll give you a second to think about that while I explain that. I think in your case, one of the interesting services we could provide is to distill out the one or two best stories that you feature in your book that are available in English translation, and make sure those are featured. You know, provide proper citations on the website so that people can, you know, to remind people about this great literature. But maybe there's some new book in military history that you're excited about that you've read recently.
Let's see. Yes, there are a couple actually, but in terms of the literature, Life and Fate is the one I would endlessly emphasize to your readers. It's not an easy read. It's a big, thick, hefty doorstep of a book, a big brick-sized, like these Russian novels tend to be. But it's well worth the effort. It repays handsomely the effort of, you know, moving through it. So yes, I would sort of recommend that. The two books, well, three books eventually, which come to mind, are the Stalingrad Trilogy by David Glantz. That is something I would urge your readers to take the time and trouble to get to grips with. Have you read it yourself?
I've read others of his work, but not the
Well, David Glantz is working on, he's already published volumes one and two of this trilogy. They're out. And I think volume three is in press or due to soon to be in press. I don't think he's finished it entirely yet. But that is, they of the recent history that comes to mind on the Eastern Front, they're the two books that really do really do stand out. I think they're remarkable. They give an extremely detailed operational account of the entire battle from both sides, German and Russian. So they would be my immediate recommendation. And another book, if I may suggest one, which is actually it has nothing to do. Well, it does actually have to do with the war partly. It is Snyder's book, Bloodlands. Have you heard of that?
Yes.
Yeah, that's one. Another one I would recommend as well, because I think that really does. It's a very, very brave attempt. A bold attempt, and it largely succeeds to make the comparison between National Socialist Germany and Stalin's Russia and all the suffering of the Holodomor and the Holocaust. He also deals with the Germans, the dispossession of the Germans at the end of World War II. So that's a book that really recently grabs me as well, I have to say. It's very powerful in places, very, very, very moving as well. So they would be my sort of three books off the top of my head that I'd push your readers to read.
Okay, well, that's plenty to think about. Those are, I know, at least the Snyder book, and you mentioned that Life and Fate was a doorstop, so that should keep people busy for a while.
Well, those four novels together, you could probably build a small shed with them, but still.
All right. Well, on that note, thank you very much for your time today. It's a fascinating book, and I hope the listeners will read it and then explore the literature itself.
Well, and you can get back in touch next year when the Stalingrad book's out as well.
Excellent.
Okay, thank you very much for calling. All the best now. Bye now.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye.
This has been an interview with Frank Ellis, author of The Damned and the Dead, published by the University Press of Kansas in 2011. This is Jay Lochnauer thanking you for listening to New Books in Military History. I hope you'll come back.
Equal Opportunity in Education by Mikhail Bakunin. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The first topic for consideration today is this. Will it be feasible for the working masses to know complete emancipation as long as the education available to those masses continues to be inferior to that bestowed upon the bourgeois? Or, in more general terms, as long as there exists any class, be it numerous or otherwise, which, by virtue of birth, is entitled to a superior education and a more complete instruction? Does not the question answer itself? Is it not self-evident that of any two persons endowed by nature with roughly equivalent intelligence, one will have the edge, the one whose mind will have been broadened by learning, and who, having better grasped the interrelationships of natural and social phenomena, what we might term the laws of nature and of society, will the more readily and more fully grasp the nature of his surroundings, and that this one will feel, let us say, a greater liberty, and in practical terms, show a greater aptitude and capability than his fellow. It is natural that he who knows more will dominate him who knows less. And were this disparity of education, and education in learning, the only one to exist between two classes, would not all the others swiftly follow, until the world of men itself, in its present circumstances, that is, until it was again divided into a mass of slaves and a tiny number of rulers, the former laboring away as they do today, to the advantage of the latter? Now we see why the bourgeois socialists demand only a little education for the people, a soupçon more than they currently receive, whereas we socialist democrats demand, on the people's behalf, complete and integral education, an education as full as the power of intellect today permits. So that henceforth there may not be any class over the workers by virtue of superior education, and therefore able to dominate and exploit them. The bourgeois socialists want to see the retention of the class system, each class, they contend, fulfilling a specific social function, one specializing, say, in learning, and the other in manual labor. We, on the other hand, seek the final and the utter abolition of classes. We seek a unification of society and equality of social and economic provision for every individual on this earth. The bourgeois socialists, whilst retaining the historic basis of the society of today, would like to see them become less stark, less harsh, and more prettified, whereas we should like to see their destruction, from which it follows that there can be no truce or compromise, let alone any coalition between the bourgeois socialists and us socialist democrats. But I have heard it said, and this is the argument most frequently raised against us, and an argument which the dogmatists of every shade regard as irrefutable, it is impossible that the whole of mankind should devote itself to learning, for we should all die of starvation. Consequently, while some study, others must labor, so that they can produce what we need to live, not just producing for their own needs, but also for those men who devote themselves exclusively to intellectual pursuits. Aside from expanding the horizons of human knowledge, the discoveries of these intellectuals improve the condition of all human beings, without exception, when applied to industry, agriculture, and generally to political and social life. Agreed? And do not their artistic creations enhance the lives of every one of us? No, not at all. And the greatest reproach which we can level against science and the arts is precisely that they do not distribute their favors and do not exercise their influence, except on a tiny fragment of society, to the exclusion, and thus to the detriment, of the vast majority. Today, one might say of the advances of science and of the arts, just what has already and so properly been said of the prodigious progress of industry, trade, credit, and in a word, of the wealth of society in the most civilized countries of the modern world. That wealth is quite exclusive, and the tendency is for it to become more so each day, as it becomes concentrated into an ever-shrinking number of hands, shunning the lower echelons of the middle class and the petty bourgeoisie, depressing them into the proletariat, so that the growth of this wealth is the direct cause behind the growing misery of the laboring masses. Thus the outcome is that the gulf which yawns between the privileged, contented minority and millions of workers who earn their keep by the strength of their arm yawns ever wider. And that the happier the contented who exploit the people's labor become, the more unhappy the workers become. One has only to look at the fabulous opulence of the aristocratic, financier, commercial, and industrial clique in England and compare it with the miserable condition of the workers of the same country. One has only to reread the so naive and heartrending letter lately penned by an intelligent and upright goldsmith of London, one Walter Duggan, who has voluntarily taken poison along with his wife and their six children simply as a means of escape from the degradations of poverty and the torments of hunger. And one will find oneself obliged to concede that the much vaunted civilization means, in material terms, to the people, only oppression and ruination. And the same holds true for the modern advances of science and the arts. Huge strides indeed, it is true, but the greater the advances, the more they foster intellectual servitude, and thus, in material terms, foster misery and inferiority as the lot of the people. For these advances merely widen the gulf which already separates the people's level of understanding from the levels of the privileged classes. From the point of view of natural capacity, the intelligence of the former is, today, obviously less stunted, less exercised, less sophisticated, and less corrupted by the need to defend unjust interests, and is consequently naturally of greater potency than the brain power of the bourgeoisie. But then again, the brain power of the bourgeois does have at its disposal the complete arsenal of science, filled with weapons that are indeed formidable. It is very often the case that a highly intelligent worker is obliged to hold his tongue when confronted by a learned fool who defeats him, not by dint of intellect, of which he has none, but by dint of his education. An education denied the working man, but granted the fool because, while the fool was able to develop his foolishness scientifically in schools, the working man's labors were clothing, housing, feeding him, and supplying his every need, his teachers and his books, everything necessary to his education. Even within the bourgeois class, as we know only too well, the degree of learning imparted to each individual is not the same. There, too, there is a scale which is determined not by the potential of the individual, but by the amount of wealth of the social stratum to which he belongs by birth. For example, the instruction made available to the children of the lower petty bourgeoisie, whilst itself scarcely superior to that which workers manage to obtain for themselves, is next to nothing by comparison with the education that society makes readily available to the upper and middle bourgeoisie. What then do we find? The petty bourgeoisie, whose only attachment to the middle class is through a ridiculous vanity on the one hand, and its dependence on the big capitalists on the other, finds itself most often in circumstances even more miserable and even more humiliating than those which afflict the proletariat. So when we talk of privileged classes, we never have in mind this poor petty bourgeoisie, which, if it did have a little more spirit and gumption, would not delay in joining forces with us to combat the big and medium bourgeoisie who crush it today no less than they crush the proletariat. And should societies current economic trends continue in the same direction for a further 10 years, which we do, however, regard as impossible, we may yet see the bulk of the medium bourgeoisie tumble first of all into the current circumstances of the petty bourgeoisie, only to slip a little later into the proletariat, as a result, of course, of this inevitable concentration of ownership into an even smaller number of hands, the ineluctable consequences of which would be to partition society, once and for all, into a tiny, overweeningly opulent, educated, ruling minority, and a vast majority of impoverished, ignorant, enslaved proletarians. There is one fact which should make an impression upon every person of conscience, upon all who have at heart a concern for human dignity and justice. That is, for the liberty of each individual amid and through a setting of equality for all. That is the fact that of all the intelligentsia, all of the great applications of science to the purpose of industry, trade, and to the life of society in general have thus far profited no one, save the privileged classes and the power of the state, that timeless champion of all political and social iniquity. Never, not once, have they brought any benefit to the masses of people. We need only list the machines, and every working man and honest advocate of the emancipation of labor would accept the justice of what we say. By what power do the privileged classes maintain themselves today with all their insolent smugness and iniquitous pleasures, in defiance of the all too legitimate outrage felt by the masses of the people? Is it by some power inherent in their persons? No. It is solely through the power of the state, in whose apparatus today their offspring hold always every key position, and even every lower and middle range position, excepting that of soldier and worker. And in this day and age, what is it that constitutes the principle underlying the power of the state? Why, it is science. Yes, science. Science of government, science of administration and financial science, the science of fleecing the flocks of the people without their bleating too loudly, and when they start to bleat, the science of urging silence, patience, and obedience upon them by means of a scientifically organized force, the science of deceiving and dividing the masses of the people and keeping them ablaze in a salutary ignorance, lest they ever become able, by helping one another and pooling their efforts, to conjure up a power capable of overturning states. And, above all, military science, with all its tried and tested weaponry, these formidable instruments of destruction which work wonders, and lastly, the science of genius, which has conjured up steamships, railways, and telegraphy, which, by turning every government into 100-armed, 1,000-armed Briareus, by giving it the power to be, act, and arrest everywhere at once, has brought about the most formidable political centralization the world has ever witnessed. Who then will deny that, without exception, all of the advances made by science have thus far brought nothing save a boosting of the wealth of the privileged classes and of the power of the state, to the detriment of the well-being and liberty of the masses of the people, of the proletariat? But we will hear the objection: do not the masses of the people profit by this also? Are they not much more civilized in this society of ours than they were in the societies of bygone centuries? We shall reply to that with an observation borrowed from the noted German socialist Lassalle. In measuring the progress made by the working masses in terms of their political and social emancipation, one should not compare their intellectual state in this century with what it may have been in centuries gone by. Instead, one ought to consider whether, by comparison with some given time, the gap which existed between the working masses and the privileged classes having been noted, the masses have progressed to the same extent as those privileged classes. For if the progress made by both has been roughly equivalent, the intellectual gap which separates the masses from the privileged in today's world will be the same as it ever was. But if the proletariat has progressed further and more rapidly than the privileged, then the gap must necessarily have narrowed. But if, on the other hand, the workers' rate of progress has been slower and consequently less than that of a representative of the ruling classes over the same period, then that gap will have grown. The gulf which separates them will have increased, and the man of privilege grown more powerful, and the workers' circumstances more abject, more slave-like than at the date one chose as the point of departure. If the two of us set off from two different points at the same time, and you have a lead of 100 paces over me, and you move at a rate of 60 paces per minute, and I at only 30 paces per minute, then after 1 hour the distance which separates us will not be just over 100 paces, but just over 1,900 paces. That example gives us a roughly accurate notion of the respective advances made by the bourgeoisie and the proletariat. Thus far, the bourgeoisie has raced along the track of civilization at a quicker rate than the proletariat, not because they are intellectually more powerful than the latter. Indeed, one might properly argue the contrary case. But because the political and economic organization of society has been such that, hitherto, the bourgeoisie alone have enjoyed access to learning and science has existed only for them, and the proletariat has found itself doomed to a forced ignorance, so that if the proletariat has, nevertheless, made progress, and there is no denying it has, then that progress was made not thanks to society, but rather in spite of it. To sum up, in society as presently constituted, the advances of science have been at the root of the relative ignorance of the proletariat, just as the progress of industry and commerce have been at the root of its relative impoverishment. Thus, intellectual progress and material progress have contributed, in equal measure, towards the exacerbation of the slavery of the proletariat. Meaning what? Meaning that we have a duty to reject and resist that bourgeois science, just as we have a duty to reject and resist bourgeois wealth. And reject and resist them in this sense, that in destroying the social order which turns it into the preserve of one or of several classes, we must lay claim to it as the common inheritance of all the world. End of Equal Opportunity in Education by Mikhail Bakunin. Read by Nolophidian.
Would you like your group announcement, or maybe holding a demonstration and would like it read on Radio Free Kansas? There is no charge for this service, and it gets out to a large audience of listeners in Kansas who can think for themselves. You and your friends don't have a corporate logo or brand name, maybe one to manufacture dissent and democracy instead of conformity? Radio Free Kansas is the place to have your news announced to a large community in the reddest of red states, Kansas, or as we've been calling it lately, Brownbackistan. The disappointing news is that you might not get your news on Radio Free Kansas. Sorry, if you were a cheerleader for the last two bankrupting wars in Iraq or Afghanistan, go somewhere else. How about a paranoid gun rubber trying to get your buds to go camping? Singing along some creek by a campfire playing some racist New World Order won't get you next gun show announced on Radio Free Kansas either. How about 24% of the conservative voters who go to church regularly and believe President Obama is the Antichrist or a space alien without a birth certificate? Well, you could try. You might believe in angels, demons, and magical miracles, don't you? Send it in. You never know. Or maybe you do. If you think Kansans, smart Kansans, might be interested in coming to your event, go on. Send it in. Feel free. Heck, it is free. Email to bluebarnnewscentral@gmail.com, no space. please provide some contact information like an email or a phone number. And thank you for listening to Radio Free Kansas.
Chapter 12 of The River War. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain and is read by Mark Smith of Simpsonville, South Carolina. The River War by Winston Churchill. Chapter 12, The Battle of the Atbara. April 8, 1898. In the evening of Thursday, the 7th of April, the army at Umdabia paraded for the attack on Mahmud Zarima. The camp lay in the scrub which grows by the banks of the Atbara, as by those of the Nile, and in order to profit by the open, level ground, the four infantry brigades moved by parallel routes into the desert, and then formed facing southeast in column of brigade squares, the British brigade leading. The mounted forces, with four batteries of artillery, waited in camp until 2 o'clock the next morning and did not break their march. The distance from the river bank to the open plain was perhaps a mile and a half, and the whole infantry force had cleared the scrub by 6 o'clock. The sun was setting, and the red glow, brightening the sandy hillocks, made the western horizon indefinite, so that it was hard to tell where the desert ended and the sky began. A few gazelle, intercepted on their way to the water by the unexpected movement of troops, trotted slowly away in the distance, white spots on the rosy brown of the sand, and on the great plain 12,000 infantry, conscious of their strength and eager to encounter the enemy, were beautifully arranged in four solid masses. Then the march began. The actual distance from the camp to the Dervish position was scarcely 7 miles, but the circle necessary to avoid the bushes and the gradual bends of the river added perhaps another 5 to the length of the road. The pace of the advance was slow, and the troops had not gone far when the sun sank, and with hardly an interval of twilight, darkness enveloped everything. In the stillness of the night, the brigades moved steadily forward, and only the regular scrunching of the hard sand betrayed the advance of an overwhelming force upon their enemies. No operation of a war is more critical than a night march. Over and over again in every country, frightful disaster has overtaken the rash or daring force that has attempted it. In the gloom, the shape and aspect of the ground are altered. Places well known by daylight appear strange and unrecognizable. The smallest obstacle impedes the column, which can only crawl sluggishly forward with continual checks and halts. The effect of the gloom upon the nerves of the soldiers is not less than on the features of the country. Each man tries to walk quietly, and hence all are listening for the slightest sound. Every eye seeks to pierce the darkness. Every sense in the body is raised to a pitch of expectancy. In such hours, doubts and fears come unbidden to the brain, and the marching men wonder anxiously whether all will be well with the army, and whether they themselves will survive the event. And if suddenly out of the black silence there burst the jagged glare of rifles and the crash of a volley, followed by the yell of an attacking foe, the steadiest troops may be thrown into confusion, and a panic, once afoot, stops only with the destruction or dispersal of the whole force. Nevertheless, so paramount is the necessity of attacking at dawn, with all the day to finish the fight, that in spite of the recorded disasters and the known dangers, the night march is a frequent operation. For more than 2 hours the force advanced, moving across smooth swells of sand broken by rocks and with occasional small bushes. Several shallow khors traversed the road, and these rocky ditches, filled with a strange, sweet-scented grass, delayed the brigades until the pace was hardly 2 miles an hour. The smell of the grass was noticed by the alert senses of many, and will forever refresh in their minds the strong impression of the night. The breeze which had sprung up at sundown gradually freshened and raised clouds of fine sand, which deepened the darkness with a whiter mist. At 9 o'clock the army halted, in a previously selected space, near the deserted village of Mutrus, and about 2 miles from the river. Nearly half the distance to Mahmud Zariba was accomplished, and barely 4 miles in the direct line divided the combatants. But since it was not desirable to arrive before the dawn, the soldiers, still formed in their squares, lay down upon the ground. Meat and biscuits were served out to the men. The transport animals went by relays to the pools of the Atbara bed to drink and to replenish the tanks. All water bottles were refilled, pickets being thrown out to cover the business. Then, after sufficient sentries had been posted, the army slept, still in array. During the halt, the moon had risen, and when at 1 o'clock the advance was resumed, the white beams revealed a wider prospect, and, glinting on the fixed bayonets, crowned the squares with a sinister glitter. For 3 hours the army toiled onwards at the same slow and uninterrupted crawl. Strict silence was now enforced, and all smoking was forbidden. The cavalry, the camel corps, and the 5 batteries had overtaken the infantry, so that the whole attacking force was concentrated. Meanwhile the dervishes slept. At 3 o'clock the glare of fires became visible to the south, and, thus arrived before the dervish position, the squares, with the exception of the reserve brigade, were unlocked, and the whole force, assuming formation of attack, now advanced in one long line through the scattered bush and scrub, presently to emerge upon a large plateau which overlooked Mahmud Zariba from a distance of about 900 yards. It was still dark, and the haze that shrouded the dervish camp was broken only by the glare of the watchfires. The silence was profound. It seemed impossible to believe that more than 25,000 men were ready to join battle at scarcely the distance of 0.5 mile. Yet the advance had not been unperceived, and the Arabs knew that their terrible antagonists crouched on the ridge waiting for the morning. For a while the suspense was prolonged. At last, after what seemed to many an interminable period, the uniform blackness of the horizon was broken by the first glimmer of the dawn. Gradually the light grew stronger until, as a theater curtain is pulled up, the darkness rolled away, the vague outlines in the haze became definite, and the whole scene was revealed. The British and Egyptian army lay along the low ridge in the form of a great bow, the British brigade on the left, MacDonald in the center, Maxwell curving forward on the right. The whole crest of the swell of ground was crowned with a bristle of bayonets, and the tiny figures of thousands of men sitting or lying down and gazing curiously before them. Behind them, in a solid square, was the transport, guarded by Lewis's brigade. The leading squadrons of the cavalry were forming leisurely towards the left flank. The 4 batteries and a rocket detachment, moving between the infantry, ranged themselves on 2 convenient positions about 100 yards in front of the line of battalions. All was ready. Yet everything was very quiet, and in the stillness of the dawn it almost seemed that nature held her breath. 0.5 mile away, at the foot of the ridge, a long, irregular black line of thorn bushes enclosed the dervish defenses. Behind the zareba, low palisades and entrenchments bent back to the scrub by the river. Odd, shapeless mounds indicated the positions of the gun emplacements, and various casemates could be seen in the middle of the enclosure. Without, the bushes had been cleared away, and the smooth sand stretched in a gentle slope to where the army waited. Within were crowds of little straw huts and scattered bushes, growing thicker to the southward. From among this rose the palm trees, between whose stems the dry bed of the Atbara was exposed, and a single pool of water gleamed in the early sunlight. Such was Mahmud's famous zareba, which for more than a month had been the predominant thought in the minds of the troops. It was scarcely imposing, and at first the soldiers thought it deserted. Only a dozen stray horsemen sat silently on their horses outside the entrenchment, watching their enemies, and inside a few dirty white figures appeared and disappeared behind the parapets. Yet, insignificant as the zareba looked, the smoke of many fires cooking the morning meal, never to be eaten, showed that it was occupied by men, and gay banners of varied color and device, flaunting along the entrenchments or within the enclosure, declared that some at least were prepared to die in its defense. The hush of the hour and the suspense of the army were broken by the bang of a gun. Everyone on the ridge jumped up and looked towards the sound. A battery of Krupps a little to the right of the Cameron Highlanders had opened fire. Another gun further to the right was fired. Another shell burst over the straw huts among the palm trees. The two Maxim Nordenfeldt batteries had come into action. The officers looked at their watches. It was a quarter past six. The bombardment had begun. Explosion followed explosion in quick succession until all four batteries were busily engaged. The cannonade grew loud and continuous. The rocket detachment began to fire, and the strange projectiles hissed and screamed as they left the troughs and jerked erratically towards the zareba. In the air above the enclosure, shell after shell flashed into existence, smote the ground with its leaden shower, and dispersed, a mere film, into the haze and smoke which still hung over the dervish encampment. At the very first shot, all the dirty white figures disappeared, bobbing down into their pits and shelters, but a few solitary horsemen remained motionless for a while in the middle of the enclosure, watching the effect of the fire, as if it had no concern with them. The British infantry stood up on tiptoe to look at the wonderful spectacle of actual war, and at first every shell was eagerly scrutinized and its probable effect discussed. But the busy gunners multiplied the projectiles until so many were alive in the air at once that all criticism was prevented. Gradually even the strange sight became monotonous. The officers shut up their glasses. The men began to sit down again. Many of them actually went to sleep. The rest were soon tired of the amazing scene, the like of which they had never looked on before, and awaited impatiently further developments and some new thing. After the bombardment had lasted about 10 minutes, a great cloud of dust sprang up in the zareba, and hundreds of horsemen were seen scrambling into their saddles and galloping through a gap in the rear face out into the open sand to the right. To meet the possibility of an attempt to turn the left flank of the attack, the 8 squadrons of cavalry and 2 Maxim guns jingled and clattered off in the direction of the danger. The dust, which the swift passage of so many horsemen raised, shut the scene from the eyes of the infantry, but continual dust clouds above the scrub to the left and the noise of the Maxims seemed to indicate a cavalry fight. The Baggara horse, however, declined an unequal combat and made no serious attempt to interfere with the attack. Twice they showed some sort of front, and the squadrons thought they might find opportunity to charge, but a few rounds from the Maxims effectually checked the enemy, inflicting on each occasion the loss of about 20 killed and wounded. With the exception of one squadron detached on the right, the Egyptian cavalry force, however, remained on the left flank and shielded the operations of the assaulting infantry. Meanwhile, the bombardment, no longer watched with curiosity, continued with accuracy and precision. The batteries searched the interior of the zareba, threshing out one section after another and working the whole ground regularly from front to rear. The zareba and palisades were knocked about in many places, and at a quarter to seven a cluster of straw huts caught fire and began to burn briskly. At a quarter past seven the infantry was ordered to form in column for assault. The plan of the attack for the army was simple. The long, deployed line were to advance steadily against the entrenchments, subduing by their continual fire that of the enemy. They were then to tear the zareba to pieces. Covered by their musketry, the dense columns of assault which had followed the line were to enter the defenses through the gaps, deploy to the right, and march through the enclosure, clearing it with the bayonet and by fire. At 8:20, the Sirdar ordered his bugles to sound the general advance. The call was repeated by all the brigades, and the clear notes rang out above the noise of the artillery. The superior officers, with the exception of Hunter, Maxwell, and MacDonald, dismounted and placed themselves at the head of their commands. The whole mass of the infantry, numbering nearly 11,000 men, immediately began to move forward upon the zareba. The scene as this great force crested the ridge and advanced down the slope was magnificent and tremendous. Large, solid columns of men, preceded by a long double line, with the sunlight flashing on their bayonets and displaying their ensigns, marched to the assault in regular and precise array. The pipes of the Highlanders, the bands of the Soudanese, and the drums and fifes of the English regiments added a wild and thrilling accompaniment. As soon as the advance masked the batteries, The guns were run forward with the firing line in order effectually to support the attack. The deployed battalions opened a ceaseless and crushing fire on the entrenchment, and as the necessity of firing delayed the advance of the attacking columns, the pace did not exceed a slow march. The dervishes remained silent until the troops were within 300 yards. Then the smoke puffs spurted out all along the stockades, and a sharp fusillade began, gradually and continually growing in intensity until the assaulting troops were exposed to a furious and effective fire. From 250 yards up to the position, losses began to occur. The whole entrenchment was rimmed with flame and smoke, amid which the active figures of the dervish riflemen were momentarily visible, and behind the filmy curtain solid masses of swordsmen and spearmen appeared. The fortunate interposition of a small knoll in some degree protected the advance of the Lincoln regiment, but in both Highland battalions soldiers began to drop. The whole air was full of a strange chirping whistle. The hard pebbly sand was everywhere dashed up into dust spurts. Numerous explosive bullets fired by the Arabs made queer, startling reports. The roar of the rifles drowned even the noise of the artillery. All the deployed battalions began to suffer, but they and the assaulting columns, regardless of the fire, bore down on the zareba in all the majesty of war, an avalanche of men, stern, unflinching, utterly irresistible. 200 yards from the entrenchment and 150 from the thorn bushes, independent firing broke out, running along the line from end to end. Shooting continually, but without any hurry or confusion, the British and Sudanese battalions continued their slow, remorseless advance, and it was evident that, in spite of the fierce fire of the defense, which was now causing many casualties, the assault would be successful. The loss during the passage of the Zareba and in the assault of the entrenchments was severe. Captain Finlay and Major Urquhart of the Cameron Highlanders were both mortally wounded in the fight at the stockades, and expired still cheering on their men. Major Napier of the same regiment and Captain Bailey of the Seaforth Highlanders received the wounds, of which they subsequently died, a few yards further on. At all points the troops broke into the enclosure. Behind the stockade there ran a treble trench. The whole interior was honeycombed with pits and holes. From these there now sprang thousands of dervishes, desperately endeavoring to show a front to the attack. Second Lieutenant Gore, a young officer fresh from Sandhurst, was shot dead between the thorn fence and the stockade. Other officers in the Lincoln and the Warwickshire regiments sustained severe wounds. Many soldiers were killed and wounded in the narrow space. These losses were general throughout the assaulting brigades. In the 5 minutes which were occupied in the passage of the obstruction, about 400 casualties occurred. The attack continued. The British brigade had struck the extremity of the north front of the Zareba, and thus took the whole of the eastern face in enfilade, sweeping it with their terrible musketry from end to end, and strewing the ground with corpses. Although, owing to the lines of advance having converged, there was not room for more than half the force to deploy, the brigades pushed on. The conduct of the attack passed to the company commanders. All these officers kept their heads and brought their companies up into the general line as the front gradually widened and gaps appeared. So the whole force, companies, battalions, even brigades, mixed up together and formed in one dense, ragged, but triumphant line, marched on unchecked towards the river bed, driving their enemies in hopeless confusion before them. Yet, although the dervishes were unable to make head against the attack, they disdained to run. Many hundreds held their ground, firing their rifles valiantly till the end. Others charged with spear and sword. The greater part retired in skirmishing order, jumping over the numerous pits, walking across the open spaces, and repeatedly turning round to shoot. The 11th Sudanese encountered the most severe resistance after the defenses were penetrated. As their three deployed companies pressed on through the enclosure, they were confronted by a small inner zareba, stubbornly defended by the Emir Mahmud's personal bodyguard. These poured a sudden volley into the center company at close range, and so deadly was the effect that nearly all of the company were shot, falling to the ground still in their ranks, so that a British officer passing at a little distance was provoked to inquire what they were doing lying down. Notwithstanding this severe check, the regiment, gallantly led by their colonel and supported by the 10th Sudanese, rushed this last defense and slew its last defenders. Mahmud was himself captured. Having duly inspected his defenses and made his dispositions, he had sheltered in a specially constructed casemate. Thence he was now ignominiously dragged, and on his being recognized, the intervention of a British officer alone saved him from the fury of the excited Sudanese. Still the advance continued, and it seemed to those who took part in it more like a horrible nightmare than a waking reality. Captains and subalterns collected whatever men they could, heedless of corps or nationality, and strove to control and direct their fire. Jibba-clad figures sprang out of the ground, fired or charged, and were destroyed at every step. And onwards over their bodies, over pits choked with dead and dying, among heaps of mangled camels and donkeys, among decapitated or eviscerated trunks, the ghastly results of the shell fire, women and little children killed by the bombardment or praying in wild terror for mercy, blacks chained in their trenches, slaughtered in their chains, always onwards marched the conquerors, with bayonets running blood, clothes, hands, and faces all besmeared, the foul stench of a month's accumulated filth in their nostrils, and the savage whistle of random bullets in their ears. But at about 8:20, the whole force, with the Seaforth Highlanders well forward on the left, arrived at the bank of the Atbara, having marched completely through the position, and shot or bayoneted all in their path. Hundreds of dervishes were still visible, retiring across the dry bed of the river, and making for the scrub on the opposite bank. The leading companies of the Seaforth Highlanders and Lincolns, with such odd parties of Camerons as had been carried on with the attack, opened a murderous fire on these fugitives. Since they would not run, their loss was heavy, and it was a strange sight, the last vivid impression of the day, to watch them struggling through the deep sand, with the dust knocked up into clouds by the bullets which struck all around them. Very few escaped, and the bodies of the killed lay thickly dotting the riverbed with heaps of dirty white. Then, at 8:25, the ceasefire sounded, and the battle of the Atbara ended. Forthwith the battalions began to reform, and in every company the roll was called. The losses had been severe. In the assault, a period not exceeding half an hour, 18 British, 16 native officers, and 525 men had been killed or wounded, the greater part during the passage of the Zareba. The actual pursuit was abortive. Colonel Lewis, with his two battalions, followed the line of advance which led south of the Zareba, and just before reaching the river bank found and fired upon a few dervishes retreating through the scrub. All the cavalry and the camel corps crossed the Atbara and plunged into the bush on the further side. But so dense and tangled was the country that after 3 miles of peril and perplexity they abandoned the attempt, and the routed Arabs fled unmolested. The Baggara horse had ridden off during the action, headed by the prudent Osman Digna, whose position in the Zareba was conveniently suited to such a maneuver, and under that careful leadership suffered little loss. The rest of the army was, however, destroyed or dispersed. The fugitives fled up the Atbara River, leaving many wounded to die in the scrub, all along their line of retreat. Of the powerful force of 12,000 fighting men which Mahmud had gathered at Metemma, scarcely 4,000 reached Gedaret in safety. These survivors were added to the army of Ahmad Fadil, and thus prevented from spreading their evil tidings among the populace at Omdurman. Osman Digna, Wad Bishara, and other important emirs whose devotion and discretion were undoubted, alone returned to the capital. As soon as the troops were reformed, the Zareba was evacuated, and the army drew up in line along the neighboring ridge. It was then only 9 o'clock, and the air was still cool and fresh. The soldiers lit fires, made some tea, and ate their rations of biscuits and meat. Then they lay down and waited for evening. Gradually, as the hours passed, the sun became powerful. There was no shade, and only a few thin, leafless bushes rose from the sand. The hours of a day, peculiarly hot, even for the country and season, dragged wearily away. The sandy ridge beat back the rays till the air above was like the breath of a furnace, and the pebbly ground burned. The water in the fantasses and bottles was hot and scarce. The pool of the Atbara was foul and tainted. In spite of the devoted efforts of the few medical officers who had been allowed to accompany the force, the wounded officers and soldiers endured the greatest miseries, and it is certain that several died of their wounds who might, in happier circumstances, have been saved. Several hundred prisoners were taken. They were mostly Negroes, for the Arabs refused to surrender and fought to the last or tried to escape. The captive blacks, who fight with equal willingness on either side, were content to be enlisted in the Sudanese regiments, so that many of those who served the Khalifa on the Atbara helped to destroy him at Omdurman. The most notable prisoner was the Emir Mahmud, a tall, strong Arab, about 30 years old. Immediately after his capture, he was dragged before the Sirdar. "Why," inquired the general, "have you come into my country to burn and kill?" "I have to obey my orders, and so have you," retorted the captive sullenly, yet not without a certain dignity. To other questions he returned curt or evasive answers, and volunteered the opinion that all this slaughter would be avenged at Omdurman. He was removed in custody, a fine specimen of proud brutality, worthy perhaps of some better fate than to linger indefinitely in the jail at Rosetta. With the cool of the evening, the army left its bed of torment on the ridge and returned to Umdavia. The homeward march was a severe trial. The troops were exhausted, the ground was broken, the guides, less careful or less fortunate than on the previous night, lost their way. The columns were encumbered with wounded, most of whom were already in a high state of fever, and whose sufferings were painful to witness. It was not until after midnight that the camp was reached. The infantry had been continuously under arms, marching, fighting, or sweltering in the sun, for 30 hours, and most of them had hardly closed their eyes for 2 days. Officers and soldiers, British, Sudanese, and Egyptian, struggled into their bivouacs and fell asleep, very weary but victorious. British and Egyptian casualties on the Atbara included 20 officers and 539 men killed or wounded. The dervish loss was officially estimated at 40 emirs and 3,000 dervishes killed. No statistics as to their wounded are forthcoming. As the Battle of the Atbara had been decisive, the whole expeditionary force went into summer quarters. The Egyptian army was distributed into 3 principal garrisons, 4 battalions at Atbara camp, 6 battalions and the cavalry at Berber, 3 battalions at Abdabia. The artillery and transport were proportionately divided. The British brigade encamped with 2 battalions at Dermali and 2 at the village of Selim, about 1.5 miles distant. For the final phase of the campaign, 3 new gunboats had been ordered from England. These were now sent in sections over the desert railway. Special arrangements were made to admit of the clumsy loads passing trains on the ordinary sidings. As usual, the contrivances of the railway subalterns were attended with success. Sir H. Kitchener himself proceeded to Abadia to accelerate by his personal activity and ingenuity the construction of the vessels on which so much depended. Here, during the heat of the summer, he remained, nursing his gunboats, maturing his plans, and waiting only for the rise of the river to complete the downfall of his foes. End of chapter 12.
Thank you for listening. I appreciate your patronage, whatever you want to call it. Thank you for listening. Tell your friends about Radio Free Kansas. And as a reminder, our weeknight, late night, news night broadcasts include a lot of very good information for you. I appreciate doing it. I'm your host, Mike Adele. Good night.